Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick. Today is November 16th, 2014, and this is episode 67, the obligatory World of Warcraft episode, or Desperately Seeking Susan Express.
Ah, I see what you did there.
Welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're going to be celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the game that completely changed the MMO landscape forever, Star Trek Online.
Whoa, slow your roll, Grandpa.
No. We will obviously be talking about World of Warcraft. And you know, this is going to be a little bit of a tricky episode because this is a game that has now been around for 10 years. It has had practically uncountable iterations between patches and all of sort of the little ways that the game has grown and changed over the years. So we're going to do what we can to hit all the big notes to help you hopefully come to a real appreciation for this game. But obviously, we're definitely going to miss some stuff. And we, as always, wholeheartedly encourage you to reach out to us with any information we missed, or, you know, if you just want to share your own experiences with us beyond our social links this week, you can tweet at us with a hashtag GameBuoyExtra.
Hashtag GameBuoyExtra.
So let's get down to this in the interest of our time and yours with some follow-ups. Slaggy McWaggy, why don't you get us started?
So Nintendo has announced that their first quality of life device is going to be a sleep monitor. It's going to be non-wearable, non-contact. Basically, what they describe it as is just a device that would sit next to your bed and use, like, radio waves to measure the movements of your body, breathing, and heartbeat.
Wow. And you'll
analyze it on cloud servers.
That's wild. And, supposedly you'll be able to access this data on, like, your phone or your Wii U, in order to sort of, you know, have like a whole system of like tracking your sleep patterns and stuff.
I could see it tying in with Wii Fit like really easily.
Oh, for sure.
You know what they had wanted to do with the vitality sensor and such.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We also have word here that the Drive Club PS Plus version has been delayed until quote unquote further notice.
That's a hot mess.
Yeah. It's been a whole kerfuffle. Their servers have been down basically all the time. It's been, like, worse than Warlords of Draenor over there.
Oh.
Yeah. We also have news that Final Fantasy Explorers, you may recall, this is the Final Fantasy-themed Monster Hunter clone, where each job will have a, like, summon ability in order to transform into a classic Final Fantasy character. That feature is completely optional. If you don't want to turn into Cloud, you don't have to turn into Cloud.
Oh, good, because I don't want to turn into Cloud.
Right? Like, I'm making my own character here. I want to play as Cloud.
The Mage's 16-bit style brawler Phantom Breaker Battlegrounds is soon making its way to PC. It's scheduled for release later this year. So if you don't already have it on 360 or Vita, or you want to triple dip or double dip, then please look forward to that.
You may recall we've talked previously about the next Sword Art Online game, that is Sword Art Online Lost Song, which will be localized into English in 2015. Representatives from Bandai Namco Games have promised that the English localization will be of a higher quality translation than the previously released Vita game.
Oh, good.
Yeah. The expansion pack to Destiny, The Dark Below, will be launching on December 9th.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about that. We also have word here that Ninja Theory's upcoming, quote-unquote, independent AAA game, Hellblade, is being developed aggressively on a relatively small budget, so that their sales projections are between 200 and 3,000 copies in order to make a profit.
Oh, good. Maybe more game studios should take that approach.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, normally I wouldn't bring something like this up during follow-ups or news, but I really think it bears repeating, like, I'm not a huge Ninja Theory fan, but I think this is great. I have talked here quite a bit over the years about how, you know, I really see sort of the over-budgeting issue being a huge part of why so many studios have closed down recently. So to see a smaller dev sort of prioritize, like, hey, let's make sure that we're making a great game that can also be profitable. Like, I think that's a great thing. I'm really excited about this, and I hope it goes well for Ninja Theory, even if I don't buy the game myself.
We have some amiibo news. Two more waves of Amiibo are hitting early next year in kind of some different iterations in different regions. The Amiibo that are coming are Rosalina and Luma, Lucario, Bowser, Toon Link, Sheik, Ike, Mennonite, King Dedede, Shulk, Sonic, and Mega Man. And basically these will be available in January and February 2015 in the Japan, North America, and European regions with kind of some different release patterns.
Man, the Mega Man one looks so good.
It really does. Like, all these, I think all the Amiibo sculpts look really great so far.
Yeah, I definitely agree. In other Final Fantasy news, we have word that Final Fantasy VII Advent Children is going to be getting another line of Play Arts figures. This new line is going to have sculpts of Cloud, Tifa, Barret, and Red 13. We're going to link you to the post on Silicon Era over at GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
And, you know, I have to say, I'm always a big fan of the Play Arts stuff, especially as, right, like, the line has grown to, you know, Play Arts Kai they're on now. And these sculpts are incredible.
They are. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of 7, but these are some, like, even the Red 13 sculpt looks really good. And, like, LOL Nanaki.
You know, the funny thing
I'm probably going to get a bunch of, like, hate. How dare you insult Nanaki?
You know, the funny thing is, I don't like Final Fantasy 7 that much, but for some reason, I love Advent Children. So I'm actually really excited about this. I'll probably buy the Cloud and Tifa ones.
Yeah, there's a one of the screenshots over on Silicon Era is just Tifa's head with a bunch of hands. It's kind of creepy.
We also have news here that The Banner Saga and Armicrog are both going to be getting ports to PlayStation 4 in early 2015.
Oh, good. Stuff to play on PS4.
Yeah, right? It's kind of crazy. PS4 is becoming a great machine for, like, indie games and sort of under-the-radar gems.
Well, that's kind of what happened to the Vita.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was just playing Spelunky the other day on PS4. Like, and, you know, I've played it before, but, man, that game is so good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In some amazing news, Bravely Default songs are coming to Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy Curtain Call. Yes! These songs include the boss theme of Bravely Default, That Person's Name Is, the final boss song, The Horizon Devouring Serpent, and then The Evil Flight. Those are all battle songs.
And there will also be a field song for The Horizon of Light and Shadow.
Yes.
So, you know, this is super exciting news. Bravely Default had amazing music.
It had amazing everything.
We're huge fans of Theater Rhythm here generally on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
So this is just exciting all around on every level.
Yeah. The next Sega 3D Classics batch for the 3DS is coming to the West.
Woohoo!
That includes 3D Afterburner 2, 3D Fantasy Zone, 3D Outrun, 3D Fantasy Zone 2, and 3D Thunderblade, each costing $5.99 or €4.99 or £4.49.
That is so exciting. The first release in this line is going to be 3D Afterburner 2, which is going to hit in early 2015, with the rest to follow shortly thereafter.
Lovely. Oh, and other Final Fantasy VII news. Final Fantasy VII G-Bike is
now
in Japan. Yeah.
In Japan.
It has been confirmed for a Western release, of course, but no release date yet announced. Okay, I have to admit, it looks kind of fun.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about this. In other Square Enix news, we finally have a release date for the Japanese release of Dragon Quest Heroes. That's going to be hitting in Japan on February 26th. And we have a couple of other news or release date updates here for you. Yakuza 0 is going to be coming out in Japan on March 12th. Dragon Ball Xenoverse is going to be releasing in the US on February 17th. And Final Fantasy 13 2 for PC is going to be releasing on December 11th.
Nice.
It will support a 60 frames per second frame rate and have settings for a 1080p resolution.
Ooh, lock that down.
So, you know, it's worth mention, really, that, you know, when the Final Fantasy 13 PC port first hit, a lot of gamers were very disappointed with the lack of graphical settings and options in the game, but clearly Square Enix is listening and doing what they can to sort of, you know, work with fans to give them the product that they want. I think that's a very good thing. Slag, unless you have anything to add, I think it's time to get over to news.
Hang on. News.
News. News. News. Oh my god. News.
Oh my god. News. Oh my god. So, Sega announced and subsequently released a PC port of the PS3 classic Valkyria Chronicles. It released on Steam on November 11th for $19.99. It
cool.
was the full game with graphics options and including all of the DLC from the original release. That includes the hard EX mode, the Eddie side mission, the Silveria side mission, and the six challenge missions.
Lovely. But
something that was super, super, super exciting is that this was a huge success. You know, it released the same week as a couple of other big PC releases. A Call of Duty had just come out the week before.
Yeah.
And somehow, Valkyria Chronicles, the day it came out, was the best-selling game on Steam.
Oh, good for them.
Outselling even the Assassin's Creed games that released at the same time.
Nice.
So this was a huge success, and Sega has already made a statement, even though this game has been on the market for less than a week, Sega has already made a statement that they are very excited about this, that it has already surpassed their lifetime expectations for the product. So this is incredibly good news.
Oh, that's great news.
And if you're like us here on Game Buoy, and you're hoping that we're going to get more PC ports from Sega of, you know, some of their console output, Vanquish, you know, now is a really, really good time to throw your support behind Valkyria Chronicles' port if you haven't already.
In totally amazing news that if it doesn't come to fruition, I am totally going to throw a BF. During the concert.
She's gonna throw a bitch fit.
During the concert in Kyoto called the La Peace Dream Orchestra, pamphlets were distributed that had an interview with Nobuo Uematsu-san, of course, the maestro best known for his work on the Final Fantasy series. You know, lately he's been freelancing, still working with, Square Enix occasionally, but he wants to make a new 2D game that surpasses Final Fantasy VI. He had recently, I guess, met up with Sakaguchi-san, and they were just talking about how amazing Final Fantasy VI was, and how, it's, it has some of Uematsu-san's favorite music ever. And basically they're just talking about, you know, trying to make a game that's, you know, even better than Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, this is so exciting. I love the idea of getting the old gang back together for a new 2D RPG. I love, love, love the fact that Uematsu-san was specifically like, let's use the Final Fantasy VI team to do this. You know, Lord knows if anything will ever come of this, but seeing Uematsu-san really talk about this as something that he wants to do, for me, was very, very exciting. So I'm really, really holding out hope that this, as Slaggy said, comes to fruition.
In summer 2015, Japanese arcades are going to get a little spoopy with Luigi's Mansion Arcade.
Which is amazing! This is actually a Capcom-developed arcade experience based on the Luigi's Mansion franchise.
That's so cool. It's going to have a little Poltergust 3000 controller, basically, and you can do the ghost hunting with the flashlight and then the vacuum.
Yeah, I just think this is really cool. It's already location tested in Japan. People have played it. You know, apparently the game plays first person like you'd expect. It almost plays like a light gun game based around the mechanics of the Poltergust 3000.
Yeah, which actually is really brilliant.
In news that I'm really, really excited about, you may remember years and years ago, before the days of Game Buoy, Yuji Naka-san and his studio Probe had announced a Knights-style game that was like basically like anime-style, like aesthetic, called Rodea the Sky Soldier. This was supposed to be a DS and Wii game. And supposedly, the Wii game had been finished but never released, and it sort of dropped off the radar completely. Well, Kadokawa Games announced last week that the game is now completed for Wii U and 3DS, will be releasing in spring 2015. And even more exciting is that the Wii U version is going to have, as a first print bonus, copies of the original Wii game that was finished but never released. So this is, to me, really super exciting. I've always thought this game sounded really interesting, and I am super happy. Like, this is one of those things that I always get really excited. Like, this game was finished for Wii and never released, and now it's going to have a limited release. That's exciting.
Nice.
So please look forward to it. You may recall the Video Game Awards. You know, we talk about it every year, sort of what awards are given to what games.
The Last of Us!
I was just going to say, or maybe I should say, seeing what awards are given to Last of Us. This year, they're undergoing a little bit of a change. Still hosted by Jeff Keighley, but it's now the Game Awards 2014, and they're touting themselves now as an independent venture, no longer tied to some of the...
Like Spike TV.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be airing live from the Axis Theater in Las Vegas. It's going to be airing December 5th at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, and will be live streamed globally, quote-unquote, across a record number of gaming devices, platforms, media partners, and services.
Oh, we may have to have a little viewing party.
I feel like we probably will.
Sekai Project, which is a visual novel publisher, have set up a Kickstarter campaign to continue localizing Clannad. They are looking for $140,000 in contribution. It would include the original Japanese voices, and because it is a 50-hour game, just all of the work involved in the royalties and the voice cost and the production, they want to do it right, so.
So, I'm really excited about this. The Clannad manga was actually really good, animation was actually really good. The game is supposed to be super good. It is a visual novel, but my understanding is that it's not an H game. It's just like a really cool visual novel with like a really cool story. The Kickstarter is already well past the $200,000 mark. This is definitely going to get released. The Kickstarter ends on January 9th, and if you're looking to get in on this to get sort of a slightly cheaper copy of the game, I might recommend you do so. If you're interested in visual novels, this is sort of like one of the landmark visual novels of the last 10 years or so. So if you're interested in that genre of game, I would definitely recommend you check it out.
In very cute news, the Bandai Namco smartphone baseball game, Famista Dream Match.
This is, of course, the resurrection of the long-running Famista baseball series. Famista, of course, being short for Family Stadium.
Will include Pac-Man, the Prince from Katamari, Wonder Momo from Wonder Momo, Dawn from Taiko no Tatsujin, and other Namco favorites.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this. This is in the game specifically going to be the Namco Stars baseball team. It's also going to have like a Valkyrie from Legends of Valkyrie, the Gator from Gator Panic.
Aww.
One of the alien bugs from Galaga.
Oh, Dawn is the catcher. He looks so cute.
Oh my gosh, he does! So this is really cool. Hopefully this game comes to the US. I would buy this at a high price just for Dawn and his little catching gear.
Right? So cute catchers seems to be a trend in baseball. Looking at you, Buster Posey.
We also have word here that Kenka Bancho 6 is going to be releasing for the Nintendo 3DS on January 15th in Japan. We bring this up because quite a few of these games have released here in North America. I sort of expect that this one will follow suit. This is, of course, a beat-em-up game with social school life elements.
Are they gay school life elements?
I don't believe they are gay school life elements.
Damn, because like some of these guys are pretty cute.
And last, but most certainly not least, Tony Hawk has announced that he's working with Activision on a new console game for 2015, specifically saying that fans of the old Tony Hawk Pro Skater series should be hyped.
Oh, wow.
Indeed.
Remember, what was that one that was a flop that had
Tony Hawk Ride?
The one with the actual skateboard?
That would be Ride.
Oh.
So, before we get to our discussion, there actually are still a couple of news points we need to discuss. The first one, of course, is that back on November 5th, Nintendo held a Nintendo Direct
yes,
to talk about some upcoming games. Slaggy, would you like to get us started on one of the things they talked about?
Yes, one thing they talked about was Splatoon, which I think a lot of us agreed was a surprise favorite from E3 when they did all of their E3 Direct. They revealed that the antagonists in Splatoon are little octopeople, because, the Splatoon protagonists are, like, adorable squid girls. And we also got a release window of quarter to 2015.
Excellent. That's a lot sooner than I was expecting, so I'm very happy. In addition to that, we got news that Duck Hunt is going to be releasing as a Wii U Virtual Console game. This is exciting, of course, because we will be using the Wiimote to emulate the Nintendo Zapper functionality.
Yeah, that's great news.
And that's something that, a lot of people have been hoping for. A lot of us were expecting that to happen since the original Wii.
Right.
So it's time, and I'm really stoked about this.
Yeah, I mean, just think what that means for, like, all the other Zapper and Super Scope games and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can't help but wonder if they will do like an eShop, you know, $10, $15 Duck Hunt revived. I mean,
I'm hoping Nintendo will make a 3D platformer based on Duck Hunt Dog and Duck Hunt, based on their moveset in Smash, but done in the style of Banjo-Kazooie.
Oh my god.
Because yeah, like you have a dog that is with a duck on his back. That's basically the same setup as a bear with a bird on his back.
Ah, yes.
Like, Nintendo, do it.
Oh my god.
We also got an announcement that there is now a Pikmin 3 demo available on the eShop for people who still haven't played Pikmin 3. The demo, when you finish, does make save data of your actual in-game progress that you can then bring over to the full game if you decide to purchase it. As well as that, they also released the Pikmin short movies. These are the Pikmin short films that Shigeru Miyamoto-san directed. They are available for purchase for all three films as a $3 total, and they are separate purchases on the 3DS and Wii U, with the 3DS version being in 3D and the Wii U version being in Super HD.
I like that they both have appeals.
Yeah, and they're and both out now.
I think you said $3, but it's $5.
No, it's all three of them for $5 total. If I did mix that up, I apologize. So anyway, I highly recommend you check them out. I watched them, and all three were super cute. I really like them a lot.
In news that made people go, yes!
Saving the best for last.
And get out their Deku Scrub masks, maybe.
I don't want no Deku Scrubs.
We finally got an announcement of Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask 3D, coming spring 2015 for the 3DS and 2DS, and also the new 3DS. And what's notable is that, you know, there are going to be some elements which have yet to be revealed that will be exclusive to the new 3DS. But, you know, this is going to be including some changes to some boss stuff, and there's going to be fishing. But overall, it's just, you know, a remake of Majora's Mask, which, I mean, everyone, I think, has been waiting for since the 3DS came out, really, in Ocarina of Time 3D.
Absolutely. And then that Friday, November 7th, the annual BlizzCon event happened.
It sure did.
That went that Friday and Saturday. And we also have a couple of announcements there that we want to talk about. The first piece of news that I want to talk about here is about Heroes of the Storm.
Oh, yeah.
The game is finally going from alpha to beta in January, and it's getting an assortment of new characters and maps. I'm really excited about these characters, because, you know, one is Jaina Proudmoore.
Yes!
And, of course, Thrall, from the Warcraft universe. But the one I'm most excited about is the Lost Vikings.
Oh, yes!
Right?
Like, I just have to say that, you know, the way that the Dota 2 people, like, were all, like, about the Dota name, it's like, sorry, Blizzard has all of their characters. Ain't nobody gonna want to be playing basic Dota 2.
Supposedly Dota 2 is great. But,
yeah, that's what I've heard.
But I've played a little bit of Heroes of the Storm now. I actually like it a lot.
I mean, if I ever get into a MOBA, it's gonna most likely be Heroes of the Storm.
Are you a part of the alpha?
I actually think I am in the alpha, I just haven't installed it. I should probably do that.
You should do that, we should play it, man, it'll be cool. The new maps are going to be the Sky Temple and the Tomb of the Spider Queen.
Ooh, maybe a Nibirak will make an appearance.
I kinda feel like that's gonna happen. We also got news that StarCraft II Legacy of the Void is coming along and is going to be released both as an expansion and as a standalone game.
Interesting.
So you'll be able to purchase it as an expansion, but if you don't already have StarCraft II, you will be able to purchase it as a standalone game to play all on its own.
Huh, that's an interesting move.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really cool. In slightly smaller news, a new Hearthstone expansion was also announced. That's going to be releasing shortly in just a few weeks this December. This is called Goblins vs. Gnomes.
Yes.
And as you might guess, the entire theme is new goblins and gnome cards, as well as new mechanics. It's going to have a whole new, like, equipable item similar to how weapons work, where you can put units into other units.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And you might remember the Naxxramas content was not really an expansion. It was just like a playable adventure. So this is the full-fledged expansion, the first one for Hearthstone.
The big news out of BlizzCon,
though. Oh my god, right?
Was the announcement of Blizzard's first new IP in more than 15 years. This is a game called Overwatch. The beta is going to start in 2015. Signups for it are now live. And this is a Team Fortress classic style game with an amazing art style, the usual Blizzard balance, polish, and attention to presentation. And it just looks effing amazing.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend you take a look at it. Whether you're into first-person shooters or not, I think Overwatch is going to be a lot of fun. It is going to be a multiplayer-only game, but it is also going to have a strong storytelling component, though what form that's going to take.
And it has a lot of strong female characters.
Oh, yeah. In fact, of the original announcement, most of the characters were persons of color or female. Or female persons of color.
Yeah, it's so awesome.
Very awesome. You have any more to add about Overwatch?
Nope, except that I'm really excited. You know, a lot of people are saying that this is most likely the remnants of what was going to be Titan, which was the, you know, next-gen MMO. Which, you know, a lot of people pegged it, because we don't really know anything about Titan, but a lot of people had...
We actually know a lot about Titan.
Do we?
Now. Yeah, there was a huge blowout on Kotaku that they did.
I didn't see that.
They were talking with Mike Morhaime about it, and we got a lot of information about the game. In fact, you know, even though it's a little bit old at this point, this article was from like a month ago, I think this is probably just going to be our read this week, our Smash article, if you will.
You need a new title.
Yeah, right. We'll link you over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Definitely worth a read. And yeah, it actually, at one of the roundtable discussions at BlizzCon, they even confirmed that some of the nuts and bolts of Overwatch did come from the project that was previously Titan. Unless you have anything else to add, we have one more segment before we get to our discussion.
No, let's do it. So in MOBA news that is not so great, Dawngate, which is the EA MOBA that was in development, is being closed down after 6 months in open beta. If you spent money during the open beta, you will be getting a refund. And they just basically said that even though that the game has grown, they're not seeing the progress they'd hoped for. And, you know, I mean, it's canceled.
Yep, it sucks. And, you know, certainly my thoughts go out to anyone who is working on this game. My understanding is that the game was pretty good, but for whatever reason, they just could not attract the amount of players that they needed. In similarly sad news, Japanese developer Hitmaker has filed for bankruptcy. It's worth mentioning, of course, we are talking about Hitmaker, the developer behind games like A Witch's Tale and the awful The Last Rebellion. We are not talking about the Sega AM2 team Hitmaker. In any event, unfortunately, Hitmaker has filed for bankruptcy with the Tokyo District Court. I assume people are going to be negatively impacted by this, and we here at Game Buoy, our hearts and thoughts go out to you guys in this tough time.
We sure do.
With all that having been said, let's talk about the World of Warcraft. So, I know this is a World of Warcraft episode, but I think it probably makes sense to talk first a little bit about sort of the history of World of Warcraft, and specifically the history of Warcraft as a series. You know, a lot of people realize now, but maybe didn't at the time, that, you know, World of Warcraft is the fourth game in the Warcraft series.
And I want Warcraft 4.
And higher if you include various expansion packs.
Right.
The first Warcraft game, of course, was a PC game, also had a Mac release. That was back in 1994.
Ooh, 20th anniversary.
Oh, girl, I didn't even realize. In fact, it released November 23rd, 1994.
Oh, wow. Okay, I don't know why that date's significant.
Yeah, right? So, you know, it was a real-time strategy game. Typically, you would play two-player or, you know, one person against a computer. One player would be the humans and the other would be the orcs. And you would, you know, build your little cities and fight, as you do in these kinds of games. It was super well put together. The polish was very high. And in a lot of ways, this game was responsible for the direction that Blizzard ended up taking.
And I mean, you know, Warcraft 1 really, in terms of World of Warcraft, it set the, you know, established the story, which I mean, seems obvious. But you know, even what we're talking about now with the current expansion. So, you know, Warcraft 1 was about the orcs who came from Draenor.
Well, I mean, Warcraft 1's subtitle is literally called Orcs and Humans.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, like the homeworld of Draenor was established. That wasn't like just some, you know, backstory change.
And you know, in a lot of ways, this game, like I was saying, is sort of responsible for the direction that we saw Blizzard go. Before this, they were doing things like, that Lord of the Rings SNES game, Rock and Roll Racing,
right.
The Lost Vikings, Blackthorn, you know, all of these sort of kind of left of center SNES games. But where they really found their niche was when they had done Warcraft, Orcs and Humans. The game was a huge success. I remember it at the time. I would play it over at my buddy Jason, or Seawolf Jason's house all the time.
Was he the orcs?
Yes, Seawolf Jason plays orcs.
Because they ride wolves, of course.
Anyway, great game, really good. And they ended up expanding on it in basically every way with the 1995 release, Warcraft II Tides of Darkness. And this game ended up, it released for PC and for Mac, and it ended up getting Saturn and PlayStation 1 ports.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think they were very good. I mean, that is to say my experience with them was that they weren't very good.
You know, Blizzard didn't shy away from consoles for a long time for no random reason.
Yeah, well, quite right. This was, in a lot of ways, like a bigger and better version of Warcraft in every way. They brought the story forward a little bit, explored a little more, added a bunch of different abilities and unit types. And again, it's very much a sequel to the first Warcraft. Very similar game, but bigger and better. Where things go a little bit twisty after that, and I do want to mention just for historical purpose, it did get an expansion set, Beyond the Dark Portal, released on April 30th, 1996, and just added, it added some new heroes, it added two new campaigns, and a handful of new multiplayer maps. So, anyway, where Warcraft began to resemble what we know it as now was really with Warcraft III: Reign of Chaos.
Right. And that's where I personally became familiar with Warcraft. I remember watching my friends play it, and I was never too much of an RTS player, so I just remember them playing and being like, oh, that's cool, looks like Lord of the Rings.
This released in North America July 3rd, 2002. Something interesting is that Capcom is actually the one that published it in Japan.
Oh, wow.
So this game, they made the jump over to 3D graphics rather than 2D sprite-based graphics. There were now four playable races, humans, orcs, night elves, and undead. And, you know, it's still a real-time strategy game, but they also added, like, hero units. If you're familiar with games like MOBAs. We talk about MOBAs here a lot. MOBAs actually started from a mod in Warcraft 3.
Yeah.
You know, Defense of the Ancients?
Defense of the Ancients.
Dota. And you know, so this was really the game that sort of, in a lot of ways, had the early seeds of World of Warcraft, I feel, looking back at it.
Yeah, I mean, there was, like, story quests and stuff, and...
Yeah, and you would have a hero, you would level your hero, getting new abilities as he leveled, you'd want to go buy mm-hmm. him gear and upgrade his gear, you know, killing mobs on the map so that he could eventually be strong enough to go up and attack your enemy's base.
Right.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, I remember explaining to people when I first started playing World of Warcraft, I started playing with vanilla. A lot of my friends were very hesitant to get in on that. You know, they didn't want to get in on the MMO train, because at that point, MMOs had a really, really bad reputation, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. But I remember explaining to people, like, no, it's totally like Warcraft 3 and Diablo had a baby. That is how I used to explain World of Warcraft to people. Because, you know, it would be about, like, a hero unit going on a long quest and doing a lot of, like, loot grinds and running dungeons to get random drops that would be upgrades. I feel like World of Warcraft in those early days really had DNA from all of the Blizzard projects.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about that a little more in just a little bit. In any event, I want to wrap up here because this is not a general Warcraft discussion.
Right.
But, again, we saw all of the storylines that Sidekick was previously mentioning. They all sort of advance a little bit. There was a Warcraft 3 expansion.
Yeah, the Frozen Throne.
The Frozen Throne. I bet you know what that's about. But, Slaggy, why don't you explain a little bit what that's about for our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the Warcraft lore?
Well, Warcraft 3 started out the story of the Prince of Lordaeron, the Paladin Arthas, and the Frozen Throne is where he eventually gets possessed by the Lich King's power. And the Lich King was originally, like, the disembodied soul of, like, Nurzul or something, a orcish warlock from Draenor or something, but...
No Lord of the Rings influences here, people.
Yeah, I didn't play Warcraft 3 until after I had gotten into WoW, but, like, I actually... It's a great game, even for people who may typically not be interested in RTS. Like, it's just really, really well done. There's a reason why it's so well-loved. And, you know, for people who are lore nerds, Warcraft lore nerds, like, you know, this has all the characters that, you know, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of these characters and stories and themes reoccur in World of Warcraft, so... For anyone who maybe is later to the WoW game, who is, like, really into the story and stuff, you know, you should definitely, you know, at least check some of these out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, something that I want to talk about before we get into sort of the meat and potatoes of World of Warcraft itself is I also want to talk a little bit about what the MMO landscape was looking like going into 2004. You know, MMOs that were operating at that point were like EverQuest, Final Fantasy XI was in its early days still. And you know, Final Fantasy XI came a long way. It turned out to be a great game that was well loved by everyone, that was surprisingly accessible. But you need to remember that before World of Warcraft came out, Final Fantasy XI was hard as nails, really, really, really difficult to play, and super inaccessible by most people's standards. That, of course, also goes for EverQuest.
And Ultima Online.
And, of course, Ultima Online, EVE Online. A lot of people had their perceptions of Second Life in that same realm. And so you just had these really strange games, really difficult for people to get into, not welcoming at all to newcomers.
Yeah, you tried to get
newcomers.
Me into, like, when we first met, you tried to get me into Final Fantasy XI, and I just was not having it.
Yeah, Final Fantasy XI, to me, it's a very great experience. I love Final Fantasy XI. Hell, I love Ultima, and I love EverQuest. I played all of these games, and they were great for what they are, but especially looking back, they're just really super obtuse. Most of them had monthly fees associated, and I just remember the landscape being very unwelcoming. In general, people had a very low opinion of massively multiplayer online games at that point. And there were two games in 2004 that I really felt started to turn the tide on that perception. And the first, and we're not going to talk about it, I just feel that this game doesn't get nearly the props it's due, is City of Heroes.
Oh, yeah, I remember City of Heroes.
City of Heroes came out, what, 6 or 7 months before World of Warcraft. It was a superhero-themed MMO. You got to build a superhero, select from a whole assortment of superpowers and costumes and stuff. And, you know, they added onto it, too, and gave it, it has some great content patches where you could build, like, a superhero base and stuff. But anyway, I don't want to talk about City of Heroes. This isn't City of Heroes buoy. I just really wanted to shout out to it because I thought it was a great game.
Yeah, City of Heroes was all right.
That really set the stage for WoW later that year to really change perceptions of MMOs. Now, World of Warcraft was originally announced even before Warcraft 3 came out. It was announced specifically at the European Computer Trade Show in September of 2001. Development of the game took roughly 4 to 5 years. It did go through an extensive training period, and the earliest versions of WoW actually were running in the Warcraft 3 engine.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, people were really, really, really excited about World of Warcraft for years. But at the same time, you know, it was announced in 2001. It didn't release until 2004. To a lot of people felt that this was going to be Blizzard's next vaporware. I remember up until the game actually hit, and even for a little bit afterwards, people didn't believe this was a real game that was going to get made. Of course, as we know now, the game does exist, the game is real, and more people have played this in North America than probably any other MMO.
Yeah.
So, Slaggy, I know that you are a big fan of World of Warcraft. It is largely because you wanted to do an episode on this that we are talking about it. Why don't you get us started by explaining a little bit about the release information of the original World of Warcraft game?
All right, so World of Warcraft, the original game, came out on November 23rd, 2004, the 10-year anniversary of the original Warcraft release. You know, they were definitely not expecting the huge initial player launch base. You know, they often repeat a story about, you know, where they went to Fry's Electronics down in Irvine, which is where Blizzard's based, and that, you know, they expected there to be, like, you know, maybe, like, 200 people, but there are something like 4,000 or 5,000 people. And they were basically there until, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning signing boxes, and then went back to Blizzard to, you know, to deal with the overwhelming demand on the servers, where they just had to basically flip them all on instead of roll them out gradually. So it was a huge, you know, player base at launch.
Well, yeah, and this, it was an absolute clusterfuck. Pardon my French, but there's no other way to describe it.
Did you play on launch day?
I did not play on launch day. I got in about 2 or 3 months after it came out. I very distinctly remember a Penny Arcade comic is what made me wait. They basically did a comic about, you know, LOL getting into a queue and getting booted from the queue before you can even get into the game. And they basically said that they were having the time of their lives as gamers when they could play, but that as the game was released, they felt it was basically broken and should not have been released at all.
Back when Penny Arcade's opinion actually was valuable.
Well, yeah, because that's actually a really great insight. If I had bought the game then, I would definitely have not become the fan of it that I am now. I definitely would have been put off by the fact that for weeks you could not play this game at all. Like, it was so popular, you basically couldn't play it because of how popular it was. That would have been a deal breaker for me that I probably would have clung to irrationally for a really long time.
Yeah, I know you. That probably would have been true.
So instead, you know, I waited a couple months, and then once I knew that I knew one or two people that were playing, most of my friends were still not willing to give an MMO a fair shake, but a couple of my online friends were playing. They were in a gay guild over on Proudmoore. Stonewall Champions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, all right, well, I'm going to hop in on this game. And so I did, and I had a blast. I played for, you know, a long time. I dropped out sort of toward the end. The requirements for raiding back then were so ridiculous. Mounts were so expensive. You could play the game for months and not save up enough gold to get your first mount. And, you know, the World of Warcraft back then, it was a big world. You know, certainly it's bigger now, but at the time, there was no other game, really, with that kind of scale.
Yeah, and I mean, that was an intentional design as well, to prevent player collision.
Yeah, absolutely. So, not having a mount, and, you know, I couldn't get into raiding because I didn't have gear with the right elemental resistances, and there were just a lot of little reasons. My interest sort of weaned off a little bit. I dropped out, and, you know, started, you know, focusing a little more on my social life, because I was playing hours a day.
Yeah, like, this is the time where, like, I was busy with school, and I never, like, really saw you, because you were apparently playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah, well, I had gotten...
You were also working, like, graveyard shifts, so, like, yeah.
But yeah, anyway. Well, my whole life was basically WoW and work. I had just gotten out of a pretty shitty relationship with a live-in boyfriend, and, yeah, it was just, you know, I'm not ready to be social, but I can totally do this online game and talk with people that way and not go, you know, stir crazy alone. So World of Warcraft was really helpful to me in that time. And yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a great game.
Tell us what your first character was.
My first character was a human warrior named Spikepoint, who lives on Proudmoore.
That name sounds familiar.
Right? You know, actually, I was saying he lives on Proudmoore, but he doesn't. He actually has since been race changed and server changed.
Oh,
he lives as Hersing on the Blade's Edge server now.
Yeah, that's a whole other bucket of all the microtransactions.
Right. But anyway, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit, because I had a lot of MMO experience relative at this point to most WoW players, I think. But I really wanted to talk about some of the really crazy design choices that Blizzard took that in a lot of ways changed the world.
Of Warcraft.
Well, no, I mean of MMO games.
I know, specifically
the quest structure, which now you see emulated in non-online games even. Like, it's a very common way to do game design to, oh, you pick up your quest here, you do your quest, you turn it in here, you get your loot and experience
M'lady.
Bonuses here.
I was trying to be like a Skyrim person.
I see. You know, that was a WoW thing. And before that, MMOs, you would get like a sort of vague, sort of like, I don't want to say quest because it wasn't like a quest, but you'd get like an objective, and it was somewhat similar to questing, but they were very few and far between. Whereas WoW was just like quest, 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 quest. Like, that was the meat of the game. The meat of the game wasn't go out and kill 40 sewer rats until you have a level up and can maybe kill some dragons somewhere. I mean, this was just like, almost JRPG style, like, here's a little objective. Once you do it, you're going to get a bonus and another quest to do to take you along the way.
Yeah, quest chains.
And guide your whole experience. Which is funny, you know, older MMOs were more akin to sort of open world games where you had very vague objectives, but you could just do whatever you wanted to get there. And World of Warcraft brought, like, a real focus on what you were doing and really removed the concept of grinding, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of us who play WoW now, we forget what MMOs used to be like. We complain about, oh, we have such a grind. I have to do the same daily every day for 20 days in order mm-hmm. to get this mount I want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, in the old MMOs, it would be like, I'm going to have to kill 1,400 sewer rats with my basic stab attack until I get my next ability.
Yeah, and by the time the game was out of beta, they took away the experience penalty for death, right?
So, yes, as the game released, there was no longer a penalty in death.
Which was a big for EverQuest, right? That was a...
Which was a huge thing in all MMOs. If you died, they penalized you. You would lose experience, you would lose gold. You could de-level by losing experience. If you had just dinged, you could unding.
That's gross.
Yeah, I loved it at the time because it was hardcore, but now I dislike it.
It's like a Pokemon losing a level because it fainted.
And something else that they did was that World of Warcraft had a rest system. Now, early days, there was a penalty for playing too much. The game would actually give you less experience after you had played past a certain point in one sitting. Like, you would have to take a break in order to gain normal XP. And if you were locked out for an extended period of time, you would get an experience buff when you came back so that you would get twice as much experience for a little while. With the idea being to sort of encourage a healthier playstyle than people were doing with EverQuest, Final Fantasy, et al.
Except these days it just means, log out so that you can get rested on your one character and then go play an alt.
No, that's what it means for you. These are changes that were so profound, so monumental, that the game really influenced every other MMO that came after it. Of course, you know, most of the characters had, you know, voiced interactions with the player. That mm-hmm. was something that really was very meaningful to a lot of people. The game had a storyline going that a lot of people really enjoyed. I'm not super into the WoW story myself, but I know, Slag, you are to some degree.
I think that Blizzard does a really good job creating, you know, engaging characters. I'm not, like, a lore nerd. I'm not a red shirt guy, even though I am wearing a red shirt right now. But, you know, it picks up where, not with every story thread, but it picks up where Warcraft 3 left off. Thrall has just formed the new Horde, and the, the Forsaken, the undead are, you know, the new addition to the Horde with Lady Sylvanas. And then, in the beginning, King Varian was still a gladiator, huh?
Yes.
It's interesting. Thrall and Varian both had very similar life experiences. I think they get along better. But, you know, a lot of the original game focused on, like, the Dragonflight, the Black Dragon, Anixia, and her brother, I think, Nefarian, right? Because they're both Deathwing's children. There were a lot of things with the Trolls and Zul'Gurub. There was, the Gates of Ankaraj. And that was a...
Oh, yeah.
And now that was a really interesting, you know...
Why don't you explain to our listeners what the Gates of Ankaraj were?
So the Gates of Ankaraj were... It was a raid patch that was patched in, and...
Well, why don't we real quick talk a little bit about how patches work in World of Warcraft. So in between big expansions, which we knew were coming down the line when World of Warcraft came out, we would get these big content patches. And, you know, again, now this is something that every game does. You talk to Final Fantasy 14 players about, like, oh, what do you like the most about the game? They're going to be like, oh, there's so many content patches. Well, that wasn't really a thing before World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
But World of Warcraft, you know, the way that they designed it, the way they set it up, the way they supported it, continuing on post-release, you would get... You bought the core game, and then they would do patches that would bring new dungeons, or new raids, or just new features, new quests, new, you know, enemies, and
change some spells around, and talents.
Yeah.
Oh,
almost like a little new experience with each patch.
So, was WoW one of the first ones to have a talent tree?
You know, I could not tell you that. I don't think so. Like, and maybe the way it's presented, but I had definitely played other games with, like, customizable skills that, I would say are analogs to the skill
tree.
Okay,
yeah. So, you know, as an RPG, each class had a skill tree, and, like, you know, sometimes these patches would change things. Like, for example, Moonkin form was something that was added in a patch.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you were talking about content patch, raid, Gates of Ankaraj.
Yeah, so Gates of Ankaraj were... there's two Ankaraj raids, a 20-man and a 40-man, and most of the raids originally did not have an upper limit, as far as I understand, in original, but then they capped it at 40, and for a while that was the de facto. I believe Gates of Ankaraj was the first one to have a 20-man dungeon and a 40-man dungeon, and, you know, I'm not being, you know, sexist here, that's just what they used to call it, 20-man, 40-man, but... Now, they would say, like, 20-player, 40-player, whatever. Excellent. Anyway, one of the things that was really cool, or was supposed to be cool, and I think a lot of people, from what I know of, I was not in the game at this point, but from what I hear people, like, in-game talking about who were there, or just, you know, hearing, just hearing about it on, from Blizzard or whatever, you know, that it was still pretty well-received, despite the technical fluke. So basically, there was a big world event involving the unlocking of the Gates of Ankaraj, which were... They were down in this desert area of Silithus, which is full of, like, all of these insects, hives, and stuff. And so it was a huge world event. And, you know, once the gates opened, they never would close again. And what they didn't anticipate is that, like, basically entire servers worth people came out for that. And so, like, it was basically crashing all night until they could finally get the gates open.
Yeah, which is amazing. you know, there's something else I want to talk about a little bit. And you know, I just looked at the time, and we should probably start moving forward here a little bit. But there's
and there was also a raid Nexdramus, which we now have seen as the Hearthstone little content. And that started to bring back the Lich King story.
And, you know, there was an event that I just want to mention real quick. It took place starting September 13th, 2005. It lasted for about a week. And this was...
Corrupted Blood.
Exactly. So when the raid Zul'Gurub hit...
That's right.
The end boss, Hakkar the Soul Flayer, had a debuff called Corrupted Blood, which, of course, was only supposed to last a few seconds and function only in Zul'Gurub, was unintentionally brought back to Stormwind and Ironforge and, you know, other cities in-game. And this disease, this debuff, which passed to characters that were nearby your character, it basically spread like an actual, like, plague, to the point where epidemiologists actually studied this event.
I remember that. I think this is honestly the first time that I became aware of World of Warcraft.
I think that was true for a lot of people. You know, this was unintentional.
On, like, on the news.
This was unintentional on Blizzard's part. This was not meant to happen. But basically, this created an entire research model for epidemic studies by epidemiologists, which is actually, to me, just really fascinating. And, you know, I unfortunately don't really have a lot to talk about it. I was not affected by it myself, though I had talked to people, because at this time I had a lot of WoW friends now, all online. And, you know, I talked a lot about what had happened and talked about it with other people, but I did not experience it myself. I just think it's a really neat little footnote in Warcraft, and the story of Warcraft, that this sort of the Corrupted Blood incident happened.
Right, right. Before I talk about the races and classes in the original game, I just wanted to talk really quick about PvP. Now, you having played some of those earlier MMOs, was player killing just something that was inevitable, or was...
Yes.
If you
played an MMO in the old days... It was very likely that at some point you were going to get player killed.
So was WoW one of the first MMOs, if not the first, to have a player versus environment or PvE server?
I wouldn't say that necessarily, but it was the first one where I really felt like you weren't losing anything.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
like,
PvP...
Final Fantasy XI didn't have a strong PvP focus, in my experience.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, and that was, you know, earlier. So
yeah.
I wouldn't say that it was the first, but I definitely felt like it was... one of the first to both include PvE and PvP both as viable ways to play the game.
Right.
Long-term.
I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that either Captain Spike nor I are, really PvP players, but I mean, that's a whole other part of the game, the battlegrounds, and then there's, you know, world PvP, and, you know, as we come through the other expansions that we'll be talking about shortly, you know, there's other additions, so I mean, just really a lot of depth to the game.
You know, I also want to mention from a design standpoint that in a lot of ways, World of Warcraft solidified the, what is typically considered holy trinity of MMO design. Where, you know, you typically want your party to consist of one or three damage dealer classes, DPS as we think them, a tank and a healer. And, you know, to various degrees, these concepts agreed in earlier MMOs, but in things like Final Fantasy XI, I specifically remember, you had your classes that were tanky but still damagey, and then a couple of, like, glass cannons that just couldn't get touched. But it wasn't, like, a clear defined line of, I am a tank or I am a damage dealer or DPS.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, World of Warcraft was the one that solidified that. And while we're on the topic of class roles, Slaggy, why don't you explain to our listeners just a little bit about what each class is and also go over the races?
Sure, I'll start out with the races first. Originally, the races were split into the two factions called the Alliance and the Horde. And, you know, people have a lot of loyalty to their faction.
An Alliance, bro.
Yeah, I tend to go more Alliance, and I'll talk more about that, my choice, once I talk about my first Alliance character in a little bit. But, so the Alliance features the humans, the Night Elves, the Dwarves, and the Gnomes were the original four races in what we call Vanilla WoW, which was the original base game. And then the Horde was Orcs, the Tauren, which were kind of like cow people, bulls, the Forsaken, which were the undead zombies, and the Trolls. And these Trolls, I don't know, like WoW Trolls are kind of different than what we typically think of as like a troll. They have long tusks. They're really cool. Our friend Amanda is a big fan of trolls.
There are a lot of fan trolls out there.
So, you know, a lot of the original classes in WoW, you know, the majority of the classes that, we have today were in the base game. There's only been two new classes added throughout there've only been two new classes added over the past 10 years. And, you know, a lot of the classes were very much from kind of like the Dungeons and Dragons classic sort of, archetypes. So, you know, you had the priest, which was like a cleric, mostly a healer, but also had a shadow priest spec, which was, for damage dealing. You had the rogue, which is like your thief, which is all just straight up damage dealer. The mage, which is a wizard, another, damage dealer, a caster class. You also had the warlock, which was more like your necromancer, controlling demons and such. There was the hunter, you know, which is your ranger. You have a pet and guns and bows and all that stuff. And then there were, you know, a couple other ones that were a little bit interesting. I mean, there was also, you know, the warrior, which was a warrior. Some of the other ones were a little bit interesting for various reasons. So, like, the druid, for example. Druids in World of Warcraft could be only Night Elves or Tauren originally. So it was, like, you know, very exclusive. You had to be one of those two races. And the druid was a, like, animal shapeshifter. So you could either be a bear, a cat,
Did they have the manatees back then?
They might have.
I never played a druid until, like, Cataclysm, so...
So the bear was a tank, the cat was kind of like a rogue. Then there was the balanced druids who after a patch had a moonkin form, which was like an owl beast. And then the restoration druids, which for a very long time were a tree, like a tree of life form. And now that's just a cosmetic thing that you could do or a temporary cooldown. Anyway, so that's kind of an interesting tidbit about the druids. There were the paladins and the shaman, and what was significant about the paladins and the shaman, the paladin, you know, was a very classic, RPG class, of course, but paladins originally could only be alliance because, you know, we think of paladins of being like of the light and heroic and good and noble, and that's what the alliance stood for. The shaman originally could only be horde. They were spellcasters. They also have a melee spec and a healing spec, so they're very versatile as well.
In the early days, there was even some
degree of off-tanking, yeah.
Yes.
And, one of the things that was really cool about shamans, and still is to this day, although there have been a lot of changes, they drop totems that have different, like, spell effects and crowd control and help, stop fears and stuff. So those were your core classes in the original World of Warcraft.
Excellent, excellent. So in the interest of keeping this moving forward, and you know, certainly there's a lot more that could be said about early WoW. We could be talking about Anixia, we could be talking about professions.
Professions were like, you know, gathering and crafting.
Like, so, I pick plants and then make potions out of them. That's two separate professions.
Right.
But we really need to keep this moving.
Yes, we do.
So let's talk about the January 15, 2007 release of the first expansion pack to the World of Warcraft, The Burning Crusade.
Yes. This raised the game from the original level cap of 60 to a new level cap of 70. It took place in the Outlands, which were the remnants of the Orc homeland of Draenor. And, you know, had been torn apart, torn asunder by fell magic. And from what I'm familiar with, was very different and unexpected compared to, you know, other fantasy tropes and stuff. You know, it took a very sci-fi sort of spin. It introduced two new races, the Blood Elves, who were, an offshoot of the High Elves who allied themselves with the Alliance. The Blood Elves were like a, kind of like a rebel offshoot of the, most of their race had died out and they joined the Horde. And then the Draenei, who are basically worshippers of the light, space goats from outer space, who crash landed in a spaceship city. And they're awesome. It also introduced the new profession of jewel crafting and other things like flying mounts. You were able to...
Flying mounts were a big deal. At level 70, you could get mounts that could mount. Fly.
So you could fly around the worlds of Outland. And, you know, so there was a lot of new content, a lot of new dungeons. One thing that was really notable about the new races, the Blood Elf and the Draenei, is that Blood Elf were able to be paladins, and Draenei were able to be shaman.
So you could now access those classes even if you weren't the right faction.
Yeah. And there were a lot of new raid patches. Some people look back really fondly on a lot of these. There was Karazhan, which is Rob Roberts' probably all-time favorite raid. There's the Black Temple, which has, you know, the... Illidan Stormrage fight, who, he is basically the brother of Malfurion Stormrage, who is an archdruid, and he got corrupted by foul magic and turned into a badass night elf demon monster. And so there's definitely like a theme of like corruption and stuff, and,
Well, and that follows even with like Zolomon, right?
Right, right. There was another troll raid added in. One thing that was really notable about the Burning Crusade is that it shifted the raid sizes down to 25, and then there would also be a couple 25 people. 25 players, and then there would also be a couple of kind of like side raids that were 10 players. And actually, Karazhan was only 10 players, but you know, for the biggest and the best content, you had to have a 25-member team. And so, I mean, it definitely, from the experiences that I remember, I was too low level in Burning Crusade to raid, but, you know, it definitely seemed a lot less like, oh, you gotta get 40 people together in one night, but still, you know, I joined the game about a year into the Burning Crusade, so...
Hold on, because I'm gonna ask you that question, so sit on that for a
minute. Okay.
You know, so this was really interesting, the Burning Crusade. I very distinctly remember, because I had dropped out of WoW a little bit before the end of Vanilla, as I mentioned. I did come back probably 6 months into the Burning Crusade, and I was playing for a while before you jumped in, Slagkick.
Yes.
If you remember, in fact, I feel like you were here watching me play as my Blood Elf Warlock when you decided to give it a go.
Because your Blood Elf Warlock was a little bit higher level.
Yeah, although eventually it didn't matter. But anyway.
Right.
You know, so the game was well received. I remember it pretty much across the board, it was considered a vast improvement over the original game from a gameplay perspective. The quests were expanded on. There were new kinds of objectives. There was more variety. It wasn't necessarily just run from one place, then to another place, all the way across, you know, a zone.
The PvP realm, they added arenas, are very popular and considered kind of the more hardcore of the PvP.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if I'm thinking back, the only problem I really remember hearing a lot was that basically the expansion felt like a sort of aside, like the new areas were not really connected to Azeroth proper at all. There's like a clear progression that once you were done with the expansion zones, you didn't really need to go back to them necessarily. Unless you were running a raid that happened to be in one of the expansion zones, you basically didn't hang out in the expansion areas anymore.
Right, even to the point where the Sunwell raid was on Azeroth. It was a Blood Alpha, like, terrace.
Yeah, well, exactly. So now let me ask you, because we already talked about my experiences with my first jumping into WoW. Now, why don't you tell us about your experience jumping into WoW and starting play as a Burning Crusader?
Yes. So I saw you, like you said, playing your Blood Elf Warlock. I was like, that looks cool. And so I went home and got the demo, and I rolled a undead rogue on the Blade's Edge server, where I still am today as Alliance, and his name was Deathclock. And I remember, because you were Horde, so I made a Horde character. I'm like, oh, that's cool, like a zombie character. Like, you don't usually see that in, you know, a typical, like, fantasy sort of, like, trope. So, you know, I thought, oh, that's really cool. There's zombies. They have a spoopy starting town. So I remember rolling Deathclock the Undead Rogue and, you know, taking him through Death Knell, which was a little starting area. And I was so new to MMOs at that point that I, like, went up to a vendor and started talking to them. I thought that people in game, like, actually, like, roleplayed and ran shops. So I was a noob. I was definitely a noob. But, you know, I really grew to love it. And, I was in a, I don't know why, I was in a separate guild than you were. I think
I was, you know, and that touches in, you know, I am primarily an Alliance player. I made a Horde character because my ex-partner was really into Horde, and he had a little guild with some of his IRL friends. And that's what got me back in, was him playing with his friends. And I was like, man, I miss this game so much. I promised myself I wouldn't resubscribe because my whole life became World of Warcraft, and we both agreed, okay, we're not going to let Warcraft become our entire lives.
Except it did.
And then, quite predictably, Warcraft became our entire lives.
Yeah.
But that's why we weren't in the same guild. We were in the guild with his IRL friends.
Yeah, and I guess that was probably like, oh, it would have been too awkward. But anyways, you know, it was actually probably a really good experience for me because it led me to have a attachment to the game and an appreciation for the game, not based on you, which, I mean, no offense. Like, you know, you were definitely...
Absolutely.
You were definitely the reason that I went for it and picked it up, but, I mean, I think it's what kept me in the game, and, like, even if you stopped playing, I would still keep playing, and, you know, so, like, it allowed me to develop my own love of the game. So I was in a guild, and they were, you know, they weren't, like, a hardcore guild, but they did do some raiding. So as, you know, I was alluding to, you know, my guild, because I think I only got to... I got to actually around like 60, but I didn't get to anywhere near end game. And I was fine. I was just having fun questing. I was a combat rogue for the longest time. And then I also, then I decided to respec as assassination, which was the mutilate spec. And back then you had to just pay gold to, you know, to change your spec, and it was expensive, or even if you want to reset your talent points. And the thing is that, like, there was a lot of times...
You've talked about talent trees, but you haven't talked about specs or specializations, per se.
Yes, so each class has 3 specs or specializations, and, you know, for a lot of them, it's just... I like to think of it as the different flavor. Like, that's how I describe it, because, like, as a... Not to brag, but as a seasoned player now, I feel like... For the most part, like, I can look at a healer and be like, oh, that spell is similar to such spell on this one. That doesn't mean to say that I could pick up a monk healer and, you know, play them. That's actually something I haven't tried yet, but, you know, so I really like to think of it as, like, the flavor of a class. So, for example, for the rogue...
Well, I mean, you know, a specialization, you pick your specialization, and that's sort of your focus.
Right, so for the rogue, there was assassination, which... focused on lots of poisons and a spell called mutilate, and it was daggers only. Then there was combat rogues, who were a little bit like hardier and able to, you know, do a little bit more like soloing and stuff because they had, you know, a little bit more combat edge, as you'd predict. And then there was subtlety, which at the time was only a PvP specialization. So there were definitely like, oh, that's the PvP spec. This is the
best
spec.
And a lot of the classes back then had, like, oh, this is my PvP spec, this is my PvE spec, and sometimes even, like, oh, this is, like, a specialized PvE role.
Right.
And
so,
PvE, we've been using this term a lot, that stands for player versus environment.
Which is questing, dungeons, raiding,
etc.
Which is what we think of most of the game being, honestly. And
you probably know what PvP already means, but that's player versus player, just to be
right.
clear. I'm sorry, continue, Slaggy.
And you know, it's just that you had to spend gold, because that was the feature dual spec wasn't in yet, we'll talk about that in a minute, but, you know, so you had, like, a talent point for each level after 10 or whatever. So you had like 61 talent points or something when you got to 70. And like if you didn't choose like the most optimal one, like a lot of the times, like especially for raiding guilds, like you'd be like, oh, are you 41, 25, 6 or something? Or, you know, like it was a very big deal. And there were like a lot of theory crafting going on. The website Elitist Jerks was a really big deal back then. Like they would like.
Elitist Jerks was a big thing until just a year or two ago.
Yeah. I mean, when the game changed a lot, but, you know, so I mean, it was a really big deal and really expensive. So, you know, really I wouldn't say that every decision doesn't count now. It's just that it was felt very final unless you, like, you know, and if you wanted to respec, you know, you really had to do your research.
And the cost of respecing increased each time you did.
Yep.
So it really started off not too expensive, but if you're one of those weekend warriors that respec every time you had to raid, before you knew it, you were basically agreeing to just have no money in your bank.
Yeah.
I knew a couple of people like that who on their raiding teams did multiple roles, and they were miserable.
Yeah, and it's just amazing to think about. And as we talk about the expansions, I choose to think of them as quality of life improvements.
Well, yeah, a lot of
people are like, oh, the game's not hardcore anymore, but...
Yeah, so the focus has definitely been changed a little as the game has grown. Are there any more Burning Crusade topics you want to talk about?
Yeah,
I was going to use this as a...
Because we started Danger Squad before the actual launch of Burning Crusade. It was August, so.
Are you talking about launch of Wrath of the Lich King?
Yes.
And, you know, it's that sort of increase on accessibility is something that we've really seen from every patch, from every expansion. And I think the first expansion, and this is for a lot of people sort of like the gold standard of the World of Warcraft experience, was also in a lot of ways the most accessible the game had ever been, and... while still being really sort of hard and obtuse, was the November 13th, 2008 release of the expansion The Wrath of the Lich King.
Yeah, such a good expansion.
My personal favorite.
And I mean, I enjoy the new expansion quite a bit, but I mean, just so many fun memories. But, you know, it was actually a little bit before Wrath launched that we started our Alliance Guild. So,
oh, yeah.
So, you know, we were already Horde side on Blade's Edge server, and this was before race changes were a thing. So our friend Doug, who, you know, now is a Game Buoy listener, Doug, who has done a lot of art assets for us and fan art.
We love you, Doug.
He was Alliance, and so he brought his mage over. He paid the server transfer, because at this time, the Oceanic Australian realms were separate. It was just very, very, very recently that they got their own region, I believe, or their own, like, actual physical realms. I mean, I don't know. I guess, are they still in our
range? I don't
really
know the answer.
I haven't really followed up on that, because I was like, oh, I thought of Doug, who's, when I read that. Anyway. So at the time, you know, there wasn't the paid race change, which now you could just go in, spend $25 and change your race. I'm sorry, I mean to say faction. So you know, you basically had to be happy with your characters. So, you know, we said, okay, let's go ahead and give Alliance a shot. And, you know, I typically like to play, like, the good guys. I'm usually, like, a lawful good character in Dungeons & Dragons for the most part. So I think it was definitely very easy for me to see the appeal. My first Alliance character was a Night Elf Hunter. His name is Thalinor. He's still active today. And my rogue is still active, too. I ended up race changing him to Night Elf as well. And I had made Thalinor the Night Elf Hunter, but then I also made a Night Elf Druid, which was his brother, Dalinor. Did you know that the backstory was that they're brothers?
I did.
I don't play on RP servers, which, you know, that is a thing. RP servers are a thing.
Yeah, role-playing servers are absolutely a thing.
Moonguard. Anyway, but yeah, I like to think of silly little, like, backstories, not too seriously. Never too seriously. Speaking of never too seriously, Rob Roberts, made his very fierce and sassy dwarf paladin, holy paladin, And so yeah, but for the longest time, I was playing a Night Elf Druid, Dalinor. He was a balance druid, which meant he was a caster in a moonkin form, which was the little owl beast. And then he also did healing, which was the restoration druid tree of life form. And I really took to that. You know, over the years, I've played every class. I still am really strongly drawn to caster classes. But, you know, I also like the melee classes and the tank classes, but I think that was really when I started to, you know, develop a deeper appreciation for the way that the classes were designed, because, you know, really, especially learning how to heal, you know, we would go through dungeons, and the dungeons were designed as 5-man dungeons, but, like, I remember we would go through sometimes and just 3-man them.
Yeah, yeah, you, my ex and I would often 3-man these this 5-man content. And then, that was great, great experience, yeah. Both in terms of experience points and just having a great time. We had a good experience with that.
Right. And then, you know, every once in a while, Doug would be able to join us. And, you know, so I remember we went through, one of the Razor Fens, the one where you collect bat poop.
Is that Crawl?
Crawl, yeah. And so, I mean, I remember doing that. And so I just remember we used to use LiveJournal back in the day to be like, hey, anyone want to do this level 42 dungeon? Just because it still took a while to level back then.
Yeah, well, it did, you know, and this is actually, I think, the last time where that was really true.
Right.
I think each expansion after this point kind of hugely brought down the experience point level requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But up to the release of Wrath of Lich King, leveling was still a big deal. Gold was still mostly pretty scarce. Mm-hmm. You didn't get your mount until 40, level 40, rather
than... But in Wrath, you got it at 30.
Yeah, that was when they finally brought it down, was Wrath.
Right, right. And we still need to actually talk about Wrath. Oh my goodness, we need to keep this going. But, would you like to tell us about your Alliance character? Because you originally brought Spike Point over, right? That's when you made
the change?
No,
not originally. I did not bring my Alliance character over for a while.
Oh, okay. You just had made a random
Rolled a mage using the new race from the Burning Crusade, the Draenei, and I rolled a female Draenei, whom I named Escaflowne. That is, of course, changing the L in Escaflowne, the super under-the-radar mecha sci-fi...
That's not under-the-radar.
No, Escaflowne is hell of under-the-radar. Escaflowne is way bigger in the U.S. than it is in Japan, and it's not that big in the U.S.
Really? I thought it was, like, super, like... It should be. Most definitely should be. Anyways,
this
is an anime
movie. I was playing this character this morning in a random dungeon with people I don't know, and a person commented on, oh my gosh, is that a reference to Escaflowne? And when I said yes, this person said, I've never met someone else who's seen that before.
What?
Yeah. Anyway.
Anime buoy.
We could do an anime buoy. Watch out. I started a naming convention with Escaflowne that I mostly follow even today, where I name all of my characters after anime features with the L's and R's switched.
So it's kind of Englishy.
A little bit, yeah, but mostly just because I feel like that's the only way I can get these names. Like, if I could name my character Harrising as Helsing, I would do it in a heartbeat. If I could name Macross as Macross, I'd do it, but instead it's Macloss. If I could do Rodos as Lodos, I would do it, okay?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm used to it at this point.
Yeah.
To the point where when there are new classes, I'm like, which anime character are you gonna do?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, before we move on to Wrath, so, I think that's...
And I still play that character. That's a Draenei mage, and she's been my main for 7 years now.
Wow, yeah. So I, this really cemented me as an Alliance player, and so, you know, I had a lot more characters that I played. For a long time, I really focused a lot on my priest, Valoon. She was Draenei. I also have a Draenei mage named Ms. Demina. But, you know, like, I'm not gonna talk too much about them, so.
Yeah, so when the Wrath of the Lich King hit, it was a big deal because we got our first all-new class.
Yes, it was the hero class of the Death Knight.
So, they call this a hero class, and that's because it starts at level 58.
55.
Oh, I'm sorry, it starts at level 55, but typically by the time you're done with the story quests and
you're
free 58 for the rest
and
of the
you
world,
can go to Outland.
And ready for Outland. But anyway, this class is the Death Knight. I typically don't refer to it as a hero class because it's the only one.
Right.
To me, that distinction is just, like, a little silly, like...
Right, they have yet to do another hero class, and I don't know if they will because of recent developments.
Yeah. So, you can think of the Death Knight as sort of, like, anti-paladins.
Right, the Dark Knight.
They're, like, undead, dark, evil knights.
Not evil, though. They were fighting free of Arthas's grasp because, you know,
so they're typically evil, and the reason your player characters can be them is because you are the rare exceptions that still have their free will intact.
Yes.
And choose to rebel against Arthas the Lich King.
Yeah.
I think that's already a great setup. My second character, my second main, like the one I play other than my main, is a Death Knight. I love him. He has race changed so that he's now basically like an undead werewolf knight of evil. And I'm super into that. I just think it's badass.
Yeah. And,
anyway, we'll get to werewolves and shit later.
And
let's go down the features of Wrath of the Lich King.
I don't get to talk about my Death Knight.
If you really want to.
So, my Death Knight, who is still one that she's not the one that I'm taking through the current content first, but she'll probably be, like, second or third. So she's definitely still one of my top-tier characters. Her name is Desdemona. She is a Draenei Death Knight, and she is really fierce and elegant and fabulous. And she's really where I, like, started to learn tank. Anyways, Northrend is the land in Wrath of the Lich King, which is a setting from Warcraft 3, The Frozen Throne, where Arthas has taken control of, you know, the undead swarms up there. It raised the level cap up to 80. We mentioned the new hero class of the Death Knight, which is really fun. Tanking and DPS class. Originally, all three of the specializations could do either role, but they kind of changed that later on. They added a new They added a new profession as well as a feature to go with it, inscription, which makes glyphs. So if you're a scribe.
And glyphs were a really interesting mechanic at that point.
Because they could change the way certain spells worked, give you brand new abilities, and, like, you know, a lot of,
So it's basically an additional layer of character customization on top of talents that would specifically change one spell. Let me give you an example. My main is a mage. One of my cooldown abilities, that is to say an ability that I can only use once every X number of minutes, is to summon three copies of myself that will fire on my current target. Now, normally, they just will always fire the same kind of attack, regardless of what my specialization is, between arcane, fire, and frost. There was a glyph for it that would make it so that they would always fire the same kind of attack as my current spec.
Right.
Which would, in some cases, be a damage increase if I had spells that, oh, you know, all fire damage on this target is increased while this, you know, effect is active or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like little customizations that sometimes were very minor and sometimes a little more major.
Where yeah, something more like, just
oh,
cosmetic.
Where it would be like, oh, this this ability now has an additional effect, but its cooldown is longer as a result.
Right.
So it was just another layer of personal customization for your personal playstyle, and it was tied to this new class, Inscription.
Profession.
Profession, thank you. Called Inscription, and people who had Inscription were not called Inscriptionists, they were called Scribes.
Try telling that to people even today, and they will not listen.
Slaggy, you were just gonna say something about Scribes.
No, just saying that Scribes made these glyphs, and, for the longest time, I don't think it was until Cataclysm that these were, every time you wanted to change your, glyphs, you would have to buy a new one. So, like, it was a huge moneymaker at first.
Yes, it was. Another addition that was made in Wrath of the Lich King was the advent of dual specs.
Yes, one of the big quality of life changes.
Yeah, a big quality of life change. You could now buy an additional spec slot so that you could have two specializations rather than just the one.
Mm-hmm.
You could change between the two of them pretty easily.
Yep, just for the cost of 1,000 gold.
Yeah, to unlock it as a one-time purchase.
Per character.
Well, yes.
Since then, the price has dropped significantly.
And, you know, this was cool as a mage, because at this point in the game, some enemies were still weak to specific kinds of elemental damage, as I briefly alluded to in the original WoW. That was a big problem for me in vanilla.
Yeah, like fire mages could not do anything in Molten Core.
And as a mage in Wrath of the Lich King, I had a frost spec and a fire spec, so that if something was weak or strong to one of them, I would use the other. So it was very cool to have this be a function in the game, huge quality of life improvement, and it made it easier to play the role you wanted to play because you had a backup in case that role didn't work for that encounter.
And
I cannot tell you as Frost how frustrating it'd be to attack an ice elemental and just get immune pop up to all of my attacks.
Uh-huh. And this was also really, really nice for, you know, people who wanted to tank and then also have a DPS role or a tank role and a heal role. Like, And that's something that's still,
DPS,
you know.
DPS is an acronym for damage per second, and that's typically what the common hand, phrasing
even
is
though
used
in-game
for
they refer
damage
to it
dealers.
As damage dealers, yeah. So for example, I have, like, on most of my classes, I'll have a damage dealing spec so that I can quest, and then either a tanking or a healing spec. And, like, it's great. I mean, it's a function that's still in the game, and, like, all of my, even my damage dealers are all dual spec now because it's so cheap. It's like 30 gold now, so.
There was another huge quality of life improvement during Wrath of the Lich King, wasn't there? Why don't you tell us about that?
It was the Dungeon Finder. So the Dungeon Finder allowed you to, instead of the old way of shouting out in either your guild or, you know, pre-arranging on LiveJournal or, going to the trade chat or general chat and being like, looking for a damage dealer for, Blood Furnace, and then, oh, shit, your tank rage quit. Better pop back out. Okay, my Hearthstone's on cooldown. I'll go back to Shattrath and, shout out. So that's what used to have to happen for dungeons.
I can barely thinking about it. That was crazy.
Right? And so what the Dungeon Finder did is it allowed you to, find groups, not just on your realm. It would pair you up with, you would select your role, damage, tank, or heals, and it would find other people either interested in a random dungeon or a specific dungeon and just use like a matchmaking service. And this allowed you to even play with people on other servers too, which was really cool. So like you would see people and like I had a lot of fun experiences. I remember when I fact changed my rogue, I remember like I went through four or five dungeons on my way to 80 at that time, and like I've never talked to these people since, but we bonded, and it was like a really fun experience. So that was like one of the times when the game really started to open up was with Dungeon Finder. But like you said, also a huge quality of life improvement. You know, now Dungeon Finder's still alive and well. You can queue up. If you're a damage dealer, it does take a longer time to queue, but the nice thing is like you can pop it up in the background, go and do quests, go and do, you know, whatever you want to do. You're crafting your auction house, blah, 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 and then your dungeon pops up. It's super convenient. And I mean, it was like a game changer. It really was.
Yeah,
and
they eventually expanded that to include raid content, we'll get to that.
So Wrath of the Lich King, just really, really great, really well designed.
Speaking of raids, I know that this had some of your favorite raids of all time. Do you want to talk about these three or four raids?
Yeah, so I'll just really quickly mention that the first raid is they brought back Nexramus. They took out the original Nexramus during a world event right before Wrath's launch, where so they took it out, and then they brought it back as the introductory raid. Now, all of the raids in Wrath of the Lich King had both 10-player and 25-player versions, and both had normal and heroic. I don't think we even mentioned heroic.
Why don't you explain heroic as a concept?
Heroic is just a higher difficulty tier. It started with the heroic dungeons of the Burning Crusade, where they were max level content, tuned harder than, you know, so you needed to have better gear, but usually meant as a stepping stone from regular content in dungeons to raiding.
So you could think of it as like a hard mode modifier.
Yeah. And so basically the way that, you know, Wrath of the Lich King worked is that there would be like 10-player normal, and then 10-player heroic was about on par difficulty-wise with 25-player normal. And then the most hardcore guilds were the 25-player heroics. And they each had, like, higher stat attributions to their gear.
And they would drop better gear.
Yeah, yeah. So each of these had, you know, these four different each of these had these four different size/difficulty combinations, which, you know, it kind of got to be, like, you know, you felt like you had to do them just to get, you know, like, filler pieces or whatever, because they would all be on different lockouts. Lockouts just mean like you can only run them once a week for bosses, whatever. Anyways, two of the most memorable raids in the game, and I think a lot of people still look back fondly, are Alduar, which was really big. But Alduar was really interesting because it had hard modes that could be activated just by doing certain mechanics. So, for example, there was like little XT.
So previously in these raids and five-man dungeons, you would just have a little menu that you would, you know, basically select, I want to do the heroic version. But here, for this raid, there were, like, requirements. And that's what, Slaggy, now go on with that.
Right, so there was a boss in Alduar in the first wing called Little XT. Or no, Little XT is the pet. His name was XT, it was a robot. He'd be like,
Everybody wants to play!
Or something like that. If you played Alduar, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
And for the people who have never touched WoW before, you sound like a crazy person.
Oh, I sound like a crazy person anyway. So anyways, like there was an element where you had to stop damage on his mechanical heart. But if you wanted to activate the hard mode to get better loot, you would damage the heart. So it was that was really interesting. There were a lot of really cool, crazy bosses, you know. And I mean, when we talk about WoW raids, you know, dungeon bosses have like, you know, run out of the fire, interrupt the spells, blah, blah, blah. Like, Alduar was one of the first times that I'm aware of that there was vehicular combat the whole entire first, battle.
Yeah, up to the first boss, right?
Right, was, you had to get in like siege vehicles, which was so cool.
Like driving tanks, basically.
Yeah, I loved it. It was huge. It was like 21 bosses, I think. There was like optional bosses, but really, really cool. Great content, well designed, and, you know, just very memorable. Then after that, they had a very small raid patch called the, Trial of the Crusader, which was basically just a Colosseum. And so it was basically, they were working on this huge, you know, it wasn't as huge as Alduar. They were working on they wanted a really well-polished and designed raid patch for fighting the Lich King, which, you know, is a huge, taking down this huge lore character, Arthas the Lich King. And so,
yeah, in a lot of ways, I would say that the Fall of the Lich King patch was the most ambitious storyline-wise, certainly,
it was.
But also in terms of raid mechanics and everything. I thought it was like the first real big deal of WoW.
Yeah, it was really a lot of experimental fights. You know, there was ones where you had to like heal up a dragon. This was the Ice Crown Citadel. And I mean, that was great. At this point, we weren't raiding Alduar's current content, but we raided Ice Crown Citadel as current content. And I mean, that was
the Call of the Crusade stuff we did current.
We did the Crusade? I guess we did Trial of the Crusade.
Yes, we definitely did.
Okay, yeah, so I think it must have been, Trial of the Crusade where we finally caught up. You know, this is where we were talking about in Burning Crusade. You basically had to run each tier or else you could not access the other content. This Trial of the Crusade, I believe, was the first one to have new levels of five-man dungeons that would give you, like, gear upgrades. And ever since then, there's been ways for you to, you know, get higher level gear
catch
as a fresh
mechanics, sort
catch
of.
Up mechanics, which a lot of people were like, boo, but, I mean, again, quality of life, accessibility, what have you. But Ice Crown Citadel was just really memorable, you know, accessible to the point of not being like, you know, crazy old school molten core, but, you know, still challenging. And like, you know, the Lich King fight was really had some crazy mechanics, like crumbling platforms and stuff. Just really amazing content. At this point, if you're in the game, it's very easy to do with high level characters. So even just to go back and see, you know, the content, it was really good. And when we first killed the Lich King, I mean, that was a really, still one of the high points. You still have the Kingslayer title on your mage.
I keep that title equipped. I occasionally will jump to like Starcaller or something, but like a Kingslayer is the one that I'm still really, like,
yeah, I mean,
I still have a lot of feelings about
this. This is
fact
over
the
point where, you know,
Rob, if you're listening, thank you.
Well, I mean, we also had Steve Wolf Jason.
Well, no, like, it was like Amanda, a whole huge gallery of our real life and online friends coming together for that. But,
right, and that's,
but of all of those friends, Rob is the one I know that still listens to our show.
Like, talking about why we play, you know, I mean, that's really what it is, but, yeah, so I mean, still very memorable, and, you know, for those of you familiar with, online gaming, Ventrilo is a, you know, voice chat software these days. You know, you could just use Skype. It's just as easy, I think, but, TeamSpeak, if you're familiar with that. So, I mean, we were all just like screaming and like good screaming and cheering on Ventrilo, like just a huge, huge achievement. And that was Wrath of the Lich King. They, what they actually did is, I think that, well, no, I guess because Sunwell was kind of similar in Burning Crusade. So, like, Burning Crusade had Black Temple as its big story end raid, and then they had one more raid patch before. And so what they did for Wrath of the Lich King is they had one little raid patch, the Ruby Sanctum, which was E-Dragon raid, and
it was like a one boss fight raid.
Yeah, and so it had a little bit higher gear level, so it was cool.
It was,
you know,
like a digest thief for the.
We're talking about all these big raids, but there was also a lot of like one boss raids, like
Maligos,
Sartharion, a lot of dragon fights. Dragon fights tend to be like a lot of the one boss things, but really cool. Like Sartharion, for example, has a mechanic where he has three drakes throughout the level. Drakes are younger dragons, and and you have to kill them or else they will attack. But there's a mechanic that if you leave them alive and, you know, manage to get the boss down, you get higher gear level. And if you leave all three of them alive, you get a guaranteed drop of a
special
dragon
mount.
So we all did our Sar 3D runs.
I still don't think I have one.
It's so easy to two, man. We should do that, like, tonight.
I wonder if I could solo it now. My DPS
maybe,
is ridiculous.
Maybe so. Like, I wasn't able to solo it at the end of MOP, but we could probably solo it at 94 or 93 right now. So
yeah, I'm probably better geared than you, too, so. Than you were when you did that, so.
No, you were. So, anyways, let's get moving.
So, at this point, we talked about how accessible the Wrath of the Lich King content was. It all flowed and played really well. Unfortunately, the way that worked, by virtue of Wrath of the Lich King content and Northrend as a continent, you'd go there. It was like a much fresher game experience. When you'd come back to Azeroth proper, you know, you'd come back to the home cities, any of the air zones for questing. It felt really jank by comparison.
The
old world felt really old and stale.
Couldn't fly.
Oh, I was just gonna say, it was really unpleasant. You couldn't fly. You were stuck to your ground-based mounts in the old world. And so, Blizzard decided to refresh the entire original WoW experience with the expansion called Cataclysm. This was released on December 7th, 2010. And the plot basically consisted of a giant evil dragon named Deathwing the Destroyer.
It's Onyxia's and Nefarian's daddy.
Threatening to come and sunder Azeroth. He, like, woke up and was gonna just tear everything apart.
I'm like, oh girl, he didn't just threaten, he done did the deed.
So, you know, this came with a whole refresh of the original game world.
The world was changed forever.
The world was, in fact, changed forever. Brought the machine specs, that is to say, sort of the way the game ran, up to, you know, more modern technology at the time, so that the game's graphics didn't look so dated, because at this point, the old world content was 6 years old.
Yep.
In PC tech time, 6 years is basically
forever.
As a result, though, there were only, what, 5 new zones to explore?
Right, 5 levels.
And instead of getting another 10 levels to go through, we went up from level 80 to level 85. In addition to that, there were 2 races added to the game. There were the Worgens added for the Alliance, and Worgen are basically werewolves, which is rad,
yep.
And goblins for the Horde. In addition to that, of course, you know, there previously had been a lot of restraint on what classes
yes.
could be, what races could be what classes. Those were majorly loosened for the Cataclysm expansion.
Yeah, they let humans be hunters, they let undead be hunters, they let other classes, most notably, I think for me, is they let other classes be druids. So Worgen, the new race in Alliance, and then the trolls could both be druids now and still can be. So that was really cool, because a lot of people, like, I have an undead hunter over on Proudmoor, bone shooter. you know, for the longest time, I was like, oh, I want to have an undead hunter with cool undead pets, and now I can. So I think it's a lot more freedom for the players to choose.
And something that really happened here with all of this new technology, Blizzard had a software glitch, basically, earlier in the game.
Yes.
Where people who had done certain quest objectives would no longer be able to see people that hadn't done the same quest objectives in the area due to the way a couple of characters' states changed whether that content had been completed or not. And what Blizzard basically did was formed a technology around that idea that they called phasing.
Uh-huh.
Where basically they use this technology now to make the world around you grow and change. And this, they started doing this as an intentional design during the final raid areas of Wrath of the Lich King and the final sort of territory, the Ice Crown Citadel zone. But it really came into its own in Cataclysm.
It really did.
Where basically every zone in the game now had multiple phasing states, and they used this phasing idea to really change the world around you and make it feel like every quest had a real impact on what was happening around you. You were really contributing to the game world. And as a result, they really focused on sort of a more guided storyline, including even use of in-engine cutscenes, like full-blown cutscenes, frequently, in fact, in some of these zones,
Alduin.
Telling complete stories.
Your very favorite Alduin.
I fucking hate Alduin. That shit is dumb.
Alduin.
I will never call it Alduin. I will never. I don't care
if it's Alduin.
It is dumb. It is all dumb. All dumb is all dumb. So, you know, and they did this new presentation, and it worked for a lot of people. A lot of people were very happy with these changes. And so this, the experience became very different. It became even more guided and, almost cinematic, which I think was a really interesting direction to take the game. And the last big change was the aforementioned Dungeon Finder expanded to add Looking for Raid, which basically introduced a new tier of raids underneath the 10-man and 25-man that was tuned lower than either of those, but accessible for up to 20 people at a time.
Yeah, this was for the Deathwing raid, the Fall of Deathwing, or I can't even remember.
So that you no longer had to arrange for a whole raid group to come along. You could just queue up, you and a couple of friends, and run a raid. And that way, now they could do storylines integral to the main plot of the game in raids, and trust that people are going to get to see this content. It was a huge watershed moment for the game in a lot of ways. Slaggy, speaking of raids, why don't you tell us a little bit about raids and a little bit about your experiences with the Cataclysm?
Sure, you know, so the raids, the first raids were like the Blackwing Descent, which took place in the Black Rock Mountains. So you actually, you know, were just fighting a bunch of like dragons and stuff, and
I loved that raid.
And then there was also, one other one that I think maybe it had something to do with Grimbutthole. Yeah, it was, Bastion of Twilight was the one I was thinking of Grimbehold. Yeah, Bastion of Twilight was the one I was thinking of. It's the, like, these basically cultists. And then there was, Throne of the Four Winds, which was a, like, you're fighting this big air elemental, and it had a really annoying mechanic where you were floating, and very frustrating.
I saw so many people die there.
Uh-huh. And then there was Firelands, which had the return of Ragnaros, the fire elemental from the fire elemental plane. And
he was a boss from Vanilla, right?
He was from Molten Core.
In fact, that was the boss that everyone needed flame resist gear for.
Yep.
Fuck and you, Ragnaros.
So basically, I don't know, maybe this was where our experience was different. When we tried to do Firelands, I felt like a lot of the fight mechanics were poorly designed. I know I'm not the only one who felt this way, because there was a huge drop-off after Firelands. But then after that, there was the Dragon Soul raid, which was pretty well-received. That was the Deathwing raid.
And that was the raid where
Looking for Raid
Looking for Raid was really introduced.
Yep. And so, again, another game changer in the same way that the Dungeon Finder was. One other thing that was really, like, a sign of things to come is they trimmed the talent point. They trimmed the talent system down from being, instead of getting a talent point every level, you had a talent point every other level. So you ended up with about 40 or 41 talent points, and they really just kind of trim out some of the less interesting decisions. And so that definitely was, you know, a big shift in their focus for class design that continued in Miss Pandaria. And there was archaeology, which was like an optional profession that you can discover little tidbits. It's cute, but, you know, ultimately just kind of like a flavory thing.
And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that Firelands is what burned a lot of people out, because I'm thinking about it, you know, for our guild, this was sort of where a lot of people unsubbed and have still never come back, actually.
Yep.
Was sort of toward the end of Cataclysm. You know, fortunately, because of Looking for Raid, I never left. I unsubbed for a few months in the expansion after this. We'll get to that. But for the most part, I stuck through it and still had a really great time.
Yeah, me too.
I liked Firelands. I did think that there were some really hardcore mechanics. And if anything, I really think that was Blizzard's biggest mistake there, was that the Firelands raid was not accessible. It required you to understand how your class worked. It required you to understand how each boss fight mechanic worked. You really needed to understand the game. You could not raid in a situation where you had people that were getting carried through. And unfortunately, our raid group had a couple of carries.
Yeah, I mean, it was a definite unexpected shift where we were, you know, a more casual raiding guild. And, you know, suddenly there was this huge shift, and I think a lot of people were really, it was not fun to them. And, you know, so I'm not going to even pass any judgment at all. I wouldn't do that. But, you know, it wasn't fun to them to grind out these fights and, you know, try and learn these, like, crazy mechanics.
Yeah, I remember there were two in particular, two fights, one where you had to have a boss, and then some ad mobs would come out. Some additional monsters would come out.
Those dogs.
And you had to keep them, like, a very specific distance away from each other.
Yep, and then they dropped, like, Crimson Prisons or whatever.
Yeah.
And don't step in the Crimson Prison or whatever it was.
And that was a big deal because a lot of people without the right add-ons, like, you know, additional software to the main WoW program, it was very hard to be sure that you had these enemies the right distance from each other.
Yeah.
And if you had someone on your raid team who didn't understand how their snare and slow mechanics worked, who was some kind of reckless and would, like, attack snared and slowed targets to break the snare or slow, you would have a real problem, which unfortunately our raid group did have a couple people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another one where if you attacked him, it would change the way he moved.
Oh, right, the rock guy, and you had,
to attack his
leg to get him to turn. It was really weird.
And you couldn't have him keep walking off the edge or something, and so you had to, like, keep attacking him to make him run in little circles or something, and... Yeah, it was very complex, very antithetical to the direction of the overall game, and ultimately, like you said, I think it did have a very negative impact on the game.
Yeah, which is a bummer, because really, Dragon Soul was a fun raid, to the point where Deathwing was such a huge, like, literally huge enemy that he took up two boss fights, one of them being which you were on his back flying through the air, and you had to, like, pry his
fly
molten scales off.
Fly onto the Deathwing's back!
Ah, I see what you did there.
Keep going.
I think a lot of people think that Cataclysm is where the game went downhill. We did see a dip in subscriptions around this time, but...
When I dip, you dip, we dip.
It was really just that Firelands patch was really rough. And the Firelands had some cool, like, daily quest hub where you had to, like, revitalize the fire plane and, like, you know, purify it of the fire elementals and stuff. So, like, there's some really interesting things in terms of, like, daily quest hubs. Daily quests being ones that, like, you could do each day, you know, repeated. So, it's just, I think it's unfortunate because I think that overall Cataclysm was not the failure that a lot of people, you know, considered it to be at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
It was definitely a rough patch after the overwhelming success of Wrath of the Lich King, though.
I agree. Let's speed this up because, you know, we're pretty deep into the episode. We still have a little bit of ground to cover.
Yeah, and we're getting to the present day, pretty much.
Let's talk about the October 21st, 2011 release... Oh, I'm sorry. September 25th, 2012 release of World of Warcraft Mists of Pandaria.
Yeah, so.
And it's worth mentioning that this is the most current content included in the base game purchase as of, today.
Yeah, and I mean, really, until just about a week ago.
It was the most current content.
Yeah, so, you know, just very, very freshly had its doors closed on it. This took you to the land of Pandaria, which was featured the fan-favorite panda ren race from
they
the
They are like Kung Fu pandas.
From the Warcraft
just get
game.
It said.
It raised the level cap to 90. So again, only 5 levels, but it felt like it took as long as 10 levels would, because it was just very slow up until...
And Pandaria as a region is huge. It has a lot of zones. It's a ginormous area. Definitely more on the scale of a Northrend than the scant 5 zones of Cataclysm.
Yeah, yeah. And so, one of the biggest changes in Mists of Pandaria that we're still seeing to this day that, you know, they've kept with this model today is the talent system overhaul. They didn't like the idea of what we call cookie cutter talent specs, where you, like I said, you felt like you had to have assigned these points here. And I know you always rebelled against that, Captain Spike. And
yeah, I was always trying to find how I could make the cookie cutter talent trees work better for my personal playstyle.
And so what this did is it revamped it down to, like, every 15 levels, basically, you get a new talent, and it will do, you know, just things like, it'll give you a new spell, or change the way spells work, give you, like, a new crowd control ability, or a new movement ability, and then a lot of the things that used to be, abilities from the talent trees just got, like, we like to call them baked in. So, like, a lot of the passive themes where it increases your, you know, such and such, or, like, you know, oh, it gives you a charge of this on your lightning shield, you know, that just became an automatic part of the spec. It also was a huge change. You did not have to train for spells anymore. That was a huge, huge change. Originally, you had to train with gold for each rank of every spell that you had, and, like, every time you leveled and there was a new spell available, you had to go back to your class trainer and buy the new rank of the spell. But they got rid of the training the ranks in Cataclysm, I believe, and then in Pandaria, you don't even have to train anymore. You just automatically learn new spells as you level up, kind of like a Pokemon, except you don't have to limit to 4. So, I mean, that was definitely a big quality of life change. you know, a lot of people think it takes the, you know, took the, like, customization out, but what actually they allow you to do in Mist of Pandaria is you just need an inexpensive material that you can buy off a vendor for, you know, less than a gold. Like, I think it's like 50 silver with faction discounts. It's like a little book from the glyph vendor, and you can change it in between fights. So you're like, oh, for this fight, this crowd control ability is really good, but for my questing, I really prefer this one. So, I mean, it really, the same way with glyphs. So it really changed the way that those were approached. It gave a revamp to the cooking and blacksmithing professions. Cooking is what we call a secondary profession because anyone can take it in addition to their two primary professions. For blacksmithing you, and other gathering, like gathering
so
flowers.
So mining, you mean?
Mining, mining, herbalism, and skinning, you could all do from level one of that profession in Pandaria, which was a big change, especially for blacksmithing, which was the one crafting profession that you could do all if level, like leveled entirely in Pandaria, which was a pain because, you know, you used to have to really grind out with time gathering or spending lots of money to keep your professions current. So that was definitely a step in the right direction. They experimented a lot with upgrading the item levels, and then up until this point, you know, we didn't really talk about how the raids worked. Starting in Burning Crusade, they would drop badges called Badges of Justice and Badges of Valor. In Wrath of the Lich King, they changed it over to a point system. I believe that coincided with Ice Crown, and it's just to simplify it and not take up your bag room. So they experimented with, you know, like, oh, you can only buy gear with it. You can upgrade your item level of your current gear to have it have better stats. And that was kind of an experiment throughout the expansion. One neat thing was that in one of the zones, Valley of the Four Winds, you could get your own farm and you would be able to grow cooking ingredients primarily. But then after you kind of maxed out your cooking, you could grow like ore to farm or herbs to pick. Or you could even get like ones that caught cloth. Like you could like take the cotton off and make cloth out of it.
And that little side feature was in a lot of ways an experiment for one of the core game systems of
a lot of people called it World of Warcraft Farmville. But it was fun. I just heard it said
World of Farmville.
You know, it took about, you know, maybe 3 weeks max to fill out your
entire
farm.
Yeah, if you
played
it every day, it only took 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah. So that was really cool. And like you said, when we're talking about the latest expansion in a minute, really laid the groundwork for that. And once again, another, like, end of expansion quality of life change, similar to how we had the Dungeon Finder in Wrath of the Lich King. We had Looking for Raid, the LFR tool in Cataclysm. In Mist of Pandaria, they introduced, for the very last raid, they introduced flex raiding, which means that in between looking for raid and normal difficulties, and it lets you have any size from 10 to 25. So, like, you know, back in the day, if you didn't have enough to fill out a 25 roster, you'd have to do 10 person raids, and a lot of times you had more than 10 people who wanted to raid, so you'd have to take turns, especially if you were a damage dealer, you know, you'd have to kind of like rotate out. And if, you know, that's why, you know, those of us who wanted to go every time, you know, like, I tanked and healed a lot because it guaranteed me a spot.
As a pure damage dealer, my main is a mage. When we were in a raiding guild, I actually did have to sit out from time to time. Not too much since I was definitely like one of our top two damage dealers. But still, you know, everyone had to sit sometimes, and
I even had to sit sometimes as a tank and a healer.
Yeah, and, you know, it was very unpleasant to have to sit.
Yeah, so this idea of flex raiding was so popular that for, you know, we'll talk about how that impacted the current expansion.
Yes.
So really quickly, the raids, I don't know, like, I don't feel like there were as many memorable, like, story raids. The ultimate raid...
I don't mean to be unkind, Slaggy, but it's worth mentioning you skipped most of this expansion.
I did. I was busy with...
You jumped in at the end.
I was busy with IRL stuff, you know, relocating, new job, new career, and everything, so...
I never quit. I played through the entire Pandaria. I took a brief break because the last raid in Pandaria, the Siege of Orgrimmar, lasted for more than a year.
It did.
So I did drop off for like 4 months there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've talked about that here on the show when I had finally...
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely... Mist of Pandaria launched in the Game Buoy window. So, you know, we've definitely talked a lot about this game. You know, one of the things that was really fun was the Monk class, which was a new class for melee tanking and healing. And I love my monk. That's one of my primary characters. You love your monk too.
I do. Yeah,
probably one of your primary characters. There's really interesting class. Really fun design. But yeah, so, like, I think the thing why I say that the story-wise it wasn't maybe as interesting or compelling is that this was really the first time that they kind of ventured into all new territory. Like, Deathwing had been around, you know, with his children were raid bosses and stuff. So this was really the first time that they were kind of just inventing their own lore. A lot of it was about, like, corruption in the Pandaren homeland of these creatures called Shaw, which were basically these, like, shadowy creatures that were kind of badass. But the final raid was the Siege of Orgrimmar, where you go in and you dethrone the current war chief, Garrosh Hellscream, who was so corrupt with power.
And
that
what is a war chief?
War chief is just the leader of the Horde.
Go on.
Like the king of the Alliance. And so basically he's become so corrupt that even the Horde wants him out. There was a Throne of Thunder before that was a troll raid. I actually liked it a lot. And I mean, I've done all of the raid content through looking for raid, and they're good raids. It's just, it might just be because I didn't experience it with the guild that maybe it was less memorable, or because
well,
I didn't experience it as
most
its time.
Of them not right. At the time. They were just catch up. And in fact, while you were grinding for the legendary quest, which you should talk about.
Right.
And you had to run the same content over and over for that. And I know that you, personally, you were getting really frustrated at doing
right.
it over
I
and over.
Right. I might have remembered me talking about, so legendary weapons traditionally were really hard to get and reserved for only one class. In Mists of Pandaria, they decided everyone has access to a legendary. It's a cloak. So you started out, this is why, you know, people who came back to the game kind of felt rushed or, you know, they had to grind it out because in each patch they introduced a new aspect. So like in the first raid tier, you had to collect these like certain like drops. And then in the next one, you had to go and do some PvP and some world PvP. And then you had to go into the next raid tier. So, I mean, if you had been playing it currently, you know, was probably not that bad to get your legendary cloak. But, you know, for me, coming back, really, you might remember, I only really came back around this August or so. So, I mean, I really did not have the time to do all that catch up. And, you know, it was a little frustrating just because of the level of some of the difficulty of, like, some of the steps of it. But, you know, I think overall it was a successful concept. And I didn't get any legendary capes, did you?
I didn't, no.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the thing is that I knew the new expansion was coming. And after the pre-expansion patch hit, which I talked about a few weeks ago, where the new models came out and, like, you know, new spells and stuff. And, you know, I've just enjoyed having fun and getting ready for the new expansion, which is...
Well, and so I just want to make one final capping point before we do that, because it can be a segue as well. You know, we mentioned that the farms were very experimental in nature. We mentioned that, you know, they were experimenting a lot with loot distribution in the end game with, you know, points and what have you. And something else is that in a lot of ways, the whole legendary quest was also an experiment. This was a quest that started in the core expansion, and you got a cloak, and you got a couple of little rewards, which with each patch, you would get better rewards for doing the successive steps of this quest. You would get, you know, an added slot for gems, or gems that would modify your gear, that were better than any other gems you could get in the game for gear modification. And we are seeing that mechanic return in the current release, the expansion Warlords of Draenor, which released last week on November 13th.
Indeed. So as of recording, we've only been playing it since Thursday, but let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, you know, the new legendary is a ring. It also has a whole quest chain associated. We don't have the final version of the ring yet, but current players who get up to level 98 can get the ring. Of course, I say 98 because we are once again back to a 10-level expansion cycle, with the new max level being 100. And something interesting is that we do not have any new classes or races this go around.
Yep.
This is just, I think the goal is all killer, no filler, new quests, new storylines, some really crazy new mechanics, including one called the Garrison System. Slaggy, why don't you tell our listeners about the Garrisons?
So, you know, a lot of games, a lot of
A lot of social MMOs.
A lot of MMOs have some sort of player housing.
Where Why don't you explain what player housing is?
Basically, a place for you to hang out in the world, like that's your own little place, like Animal Crossing. And so this essentially is player housing for yourself. A lot of people want guild housing, which, you know, that is available in games like Final Fantasy XIV.
And your garrison, you can actually invite up to like 20 people to come into your garrison.
You can. It's not a unified. Like, our guild owns this, which I think a lot of people still want. And, you know, I think now that they've done this, and it seems like not just we find it successful, I think everyone loves it a lot when it's working, you know, they might be able to take that step next. But garrisons is basically you land in the homeworld of Draenor. There's, like, a time travel element, alternate timelines, whatever, you know. Like, I'm not that concerned about it. So basically, you're back in the past on the orcish homeworld of Draenor. You establish a base called a garrison, and you start out with just a couple buildings, but you can have, like, profession buildings. You can have followers that you send on missions. And in a lot of ways, it is like a social mobile MMO game.
Well, I actually want to tie this in closer to the original Warcraft games.
Uh-huh.
You have your individual units that you send out on quests. You have a town hall, and you build buildings around your town hall in order to get specific new perks. And as you upgrade your town hall, you can get better buildings to build in your garrison. I really feel like it is a social MMO take on the core.
That's true.
The core Warcraft gameplay.
And then a lot of it is like, you know, kind of like the mobile social sort of approach to gameplay where you come back in a couple hours. So this is just one element.
But I don't know that that's necessarily that different from clicking on a peon and telling him to go harvest lumber for your lumber mill, which is a real thing that you also do in Warlords of Draenor.
That's true. No, I'm just saying that what I appreciate is that they took this model that in a lot of ways can be really shitty if it's like a, you know, a Zynga behind it, but Blizzard found a way to make this like really compelling. You can have buildings that help your professions. You can have buildings for professions that you don't have and craft a lot of the gear. You can have like you have your own mine so that you don't need to. I mean, you still want to go out and mine in the real world. You have your own garden, so you like have a collection of mining ore and herbs that like is guaranteed for you each day. And I mean, and it's really nice. Like I said, so it's like this hybrid of, you know, the original Warcraft model with this sort of mobile social idea. It's similar also to what you were doing in Bravely Default.
Oh yeah, with the village.
I would say that's more comparable because you're not spending real world monies on this. Even though there are real world money transactions in WoW.
But none related to the garrison system.
And none related to anything like advancing your skill or anything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the number squish.
Yes, so by the time Mr. Pandaria had come out, you had like hundreds of thousands of hit points. You were doing like you could have a million point critical hits. The top damage dealers were doing like over, you know, close to 200,000 damage points per second. And so like the numbers were just getting crazy. And so what they did is they did something called the item squish. And so basically like it's not that like the game is more difficult or anything. It's just that they reduced the size of stats. Instead of having, oh, there's 817 intellect points on your gear, now it's, oh, you have
37.
48, yeah. Which is, like, you know, more what you were used to seeing in the original game.
But in terms of the damage you're doing, while now, instead of, you know, my mage, for example, I used to crit for 300,000 or 400,000 pretty frequently. Now I crit for, like, 5,000. But,
yeah, but
because
the bosses,
enemy numbers yeah. have also scaled down, it's still the same amount of damage relative
yeah,
to
so,
the
Yeah, so, I mean,
total.
It's really not a big deal. It's just the numbers represented on screen.
But it was a big deal that they finally did it, because this yeah. is something Blizzard has been talking about doing since Wrath of the Lich King.
Something else that was significant had to do with the stats themselves. You know, when we say stats, we're talking about your traditional RPG stats.
Strength.
Intelligence.
Etc.
Yeah. And so there's also a lot of secondary stats, like, you know, haste increases how fast you cast your spells. Critical strike is for how many, like, you know, critical hits you get.
Well, something really interesting is one of the secondary abilities used to be hit. Which meant that, you know, you had a certain percent chance to miss, and the higher your hit was, the less likely you would miss. But they, as a part of this item squish, basically...
To hit armor class 0?
right? THACO. They basically changed the secondary stats to be truly secondary stats.
Right. So even, before tanks had dodge and parry, and a long time ago they had defense and defense rating, which were like two separate ones. So like they really simplified that. So now, they want these secondary stats to be useful for anyone, but definitely certain specs and certain classes have, secondary stats that are more beneficial than others. But basically so that you don't get a loot drop that is
But they're
useless.
Secondary. I mean, if you have the wrong secondary on your gear, but your main stats are upgrades, you'd still equip it now.
Yeah, and one
whereas in the old days, if something didn't have the right amount of hit, it would be like, well, I can't use this. It doesn't have the right amount of hit.
Yeah, and they had a system called reforging that basically you would spend gold to like min-max your points to get it just right.
But that system was deemed a failure. Quite explicitly, Blizzard has said that it just became another way for people to cookie cutter, change their gear, so ultimately everyone had the same gear.
Yep.
Like, oh, which is why gear. We haven't discussed it here, because it was Blizzard was right. Pretty clear that it was just a failure system.
And so this even goes down to the gems. You know, gem sockets are
made by Jewel Crafters.
Made by Jewel Crafters. They started out in Burning Crusade, and typically they, you know, you'd want to have your primary stat. All of the gems now are secondary stats, and not every, like, the loot is a lot more like a, Diablo style now, I would say, where there are variations with different secondary stats. Sometimes it might automatically upgrade to a epic item level.
Or a rare.
Or a rare.
You know, we've gone through this whole episode without talking about the different classes of items. Items can drop as, you know, common items, uncommon items, rare items, epic items, legendary items.
Right. Anyone who's familiar with Diablo, definitely, I mean, Blizzard, so definitely the same, even the same color scheme,
well,
right?
Well, it is now. That was not always the way.
Oh, okay.
That is definitely part of the cross-pollination that I was talking about at the beginning of this episode. Diablo 3 took a lot of cues from the World of Warcraft.
Right, so and one of the nicest changes is that, you know, with the advent of dual spec, you'd have to collect two different sets of gear. So it's like, you know, there were ways to do this. You could go into the looking for raid and, you know, oh, I'm just going to gear up my off spec with this, but my main spec I'll get from raiding gear. It's okay. It's not the same item level. Now every primary piece of gear, aside from trinkets, which are just little, like, you know, add-ons, rings and necklaces, and then your weapons, everything else has
two sets of stats.
Two
basically.
Sets of stats. So like basically, like for example, I play a shaman right now, and she originally would have had to have like two different sets of gear, but now she only needs one set of gear
based on whether you're damage dealing or healing.
Yeah,
but now the gear will change based on what spec you're in, so that the stats will be correct.
It was to the point where
spec,
like,
you're in
healing paladins, holy paladins were the only ones to have plate mail that had intellect. Intellect was like for magic users and healers, so like they were the only ones who had this gear. And so if it dropped, it would be useless. So it's really changed the, you know, kind of the value of gear now. Like a drop can be usable for anyone, but also drop rates have decreased too. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting, an interesting change. They've also gotten rid of the aforementioned Valor and Justice points, which originally were badges. Basically, you're just going to buy stuff with gold, and there are, these, you know, crystals called Apexis crystals that drop from high level content and dailies and stuff that you can use for high level gear.
To buy gear and upgrade gear.
But I mean, it's definitely not like, oh, I've got to go get my Valor points, got to get my Justice points. One thing that they had started in Pandaria with the professions, now you can level any profession starting from level 1, even in, like, you know, just starting out, if you change your profession, never bothered to get one, you can use, Draenor items and drops to catch up to the current level, which is really nice. Like, for example, I got my cooking caught up that way.
To put that in perspective a little bit, before the current expansion, for most professions that were crafting professions, you would have to go farm older materials from your gathering professions. Like, you'd have to go back to the very first early zones of the game and
copper.
Mine some, if you're, for example, as a blacksmith, you'd have to mine some bronze or whatever and make all the bronze recipes X number of times before you could get up to, you know, silver or whatever. They've now made it so that you can just in the new content without having to go back 10 years worth of content and level your professions in the current zones.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that would take, if you were starting fresh and trying to get to the current cap, It would take like up to a day, a full game.
I love that you're like up to a day. No, for most of us, it would take a couple weeks. You would use these power farming guides and stuff, but most people don't do power farming stuff.
Anyway, so definitely huge quality of life change for the professions based on the success they had with the cooking and the blacksmithing in Miss Pandaria. One thing that was also a success was the flex raids, which were the flexible raid sites. So basically what they've done now is that, looking for raid is still,
A separate lower tier,
but then now there are, three tiers of raids. Two of them are flexible size. There's, what was the flex difficulty in the last patch is now the normal difficulty. So normal raids are a little easier than they used to be. What used to be normal is now heroic. Those are both anywhere from 10 to 25 players. And then what used to be heroic is,
now mythic.
And that's fixed at 20 players, which is interesting.
It's a new number.
And
that's so that they can, specifically tune to a very specific kind of raid composition.
Right.
And make what is still theoretically, at least, really challenging hardcore content designed for a very specific type of player that wants that without encroaching on players who just want to play with their friends, be that 10 to 25 people.
Right.
And even people who play that way, but also do want a more difficult experience in the heroic difficulty.
Yeah, that's exciting because, I mean, we did normal raids, which are now considered heroic, and so, I mean, I'm excited to hopefully see if we can get some people in our guild, and even listeners, because as of, really, I think Mr. Pandaria is when they really started to bring it over is...
You can do basically anything across realms.
With the same faction, yeah. So
within your faction.
For example, Phil over on Koopa Club, one of his characters is over on Proudmore. And so, I was able to do a dungeon with her, no problem.
That's awesome.
Which is, it's always nice when, you have people on your server in your guild chat being like, hey, but, it's really become so that you don't have to feel like, oh, well, I have friends on this server, I raid with them, and I can't afford to do server transfer. So, I mean, it's really, you can do anything except, the most hardcore of raiding across server, which is nice. And so, if you're out there and you're playing World of Warcraft Alliance, you should keep in touch with us on your progress in Draenor.
So feel free to tweet at us, #GameBuoyExtra.
#GameBuoyExtra.
If you're interested, just want to play with us, we're super into WoW. We play.
Drop us your battle tag.
Anyway, to wrap this conversation of Warlords of Dandy up,
Warlords of Dandy.
We have to mention that there's no flying in Draenor.
Yeah, possibly for the full expansion.
There's no crying in baseball.
There's no flying in Draenor.
So, unfortunately, because this expansion has only been out for, four days, there are no raids up for it yet.
That'll be in December.
Neither of us have a level 100 character yet.
I have a 94.
I have a 93. I'll be 94 tonight. By the time this episode goes up, we'll probably have 96s.
Or 97, 98, maybe. I bet.
Anyway. So we can't talk too much about this expansion, but let me just ask you, Slaggy, with the caveat that you are 4 days into an expansion in which you will be spending several hundred days, how have the first 4 days gone?
I've had a lot of fun. Like I mentioned, I decided to play my shaman first, and I'm having a blast with her. I really like that there are bonus objectives. You can just walk in to a zone, and there'll be
very similar to a Rift or Guild Wars.
Yeah,
style.
Where you just go in and be like, oh, here, you kill these mobs. So it kind of takes a lot of the kill X number of blank mobs out of the story quests, but they're still out there, and you can just, and I do them all because I'm like, ooh. There are rare mobs that have a really fast respawn rate. I wonder if they're going to, nerf that or something.
No, because I think it's by design. Every rare mob now has a specific weapon it drops specific to that rare mob. It's
or
not just a random...
Not just a weapon, but an item.
Okay, they have a specific item they drop specific to that rare mob. I think it's intended, because I've tried farming, one rare, and I didn't get any cool bonuses the second time I killed it. It was specific. So I think it's just intended that if you want to hunt rares, you can just hunt rares.
Yeah, which is really cool. Rare mobs are ones that typically would take hours and hours and hours to respawn, reappear. But these ones appear after 5 minutes at the most.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally seen one fall and pop back up in 30 seconds.
Same here.
I
finished the first zone. My garrison is being built up. I plan, and this is probably a first for me, I plan on doing all of the questing content, even though I out-leveled a zone already, and I just barely started questing in there, just because of all the followers and just
followers,
you know,
are individual workers with their own personalized characteristics.
A lot of
that
what,
live in your garrison and do jobs for you.
It's in some ways reminds me of what you were able to do in Star Wars: The Old Republic, and you were able to have your companions do crafting for you. But these, like, they go away and they do missions, they get their own points, they get resources for your garrison, but, like, I thought that, Star Wars: The Old Republic definitely had an interesting precedent that, you know, I was like, oh, I wonder when they'll do that in WoW. So this is kind of the first time, you know, that they've done that. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's definitely, too early to say if it's like a return to basics or whatever, anything like that, but, I'm really enjoying it. It seems, like, you know, the zone designs, the quest designs are good. The dungeons I've run seem just right. You know, healing so far seems just right. They sometimes change the, like, potency of healing, like, Cataclysm. At the beginning of Cataclysm, healing was really undertuned, so it was really tough. But, it feels like a good balance. I think after 10 years, they've, experimented a lot. They've learned what works and what doesn't. And I think, you know, this seems like, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out, but it seems like, you know, they've got a good game plan for this expansion.
I would agree. I definitely very strongly agree. So, all right, well, with that having been said, you know, I had intended to talk a little bit about the legacy of the World of Warcraft. It's still basically the biggest MMO. I think the last time we had subscriber numbers, they were still, like, what, more than 7.5 million?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you look at, like, Final Fantasy XIV, which most people view as, like, the nearest competitor, and that's what, like, around the 1.5 million mark,
yeah.
I think I heard. So, I mean, you know,
that
it's...
That was probably, like, Old Republic at its height was about 1 million.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's still, like, on a different order of magnitude, practically, even with the fact that we are now, what, 5 million down from its peak.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's natural, and I...
Yeah,
I,
it's a 10-year-old game. And more than 7 million
be interesting,
people still play.
I'm gonna be interested to see the subscriber numbers at the next investors
we'll
call
see.
Or whatever.
We'll see if there's a jump or not, because I'm sure some people left
see.
Also.
I'm just interested.
You know, there have been a lot of tech issues plaguing this release, and unfortunately gamers are a fickle bunch. I wouldn't be surprised to see if they lost people permanently over the tech issues they've had this
week.
Oh,
yeah, especially, you know, people have been playing 9.5 years.
Yeah, well, yeah. You dick. So I mean, really, it's... And I've really been thinking about this while we've been talking about it, you know. I really feel like it's not just MMOs that have been impacted by the design successes of this
right.
game, but a lot of these lessons that were pioneered in WoW, I think, again, go back to non-MMO, non-RPG games even.
Right, but it's definitely in the MMO sphere. Like, now you look at most things and
most
like,
MMOs
oh, WoW
have
clone.
Crafting systems.
It's a WoW clone.
Most MMOs have resting bonuses.
And I think that's why when I've I've tried Rift, and, you know, I've tried some of the other ones. I tried Lord of the Rings Online. You know, I would have to say the only other two MMOs that I feel really kind of hold their own and have their own appeal are Guild Wars 2.
And
Final Fantasy XIV: A Realm Reborn.
Absolutely.
And you know what else I actually...
I also feel that way about StarCraft.
Star Wars Old Republic.
Although, one of the big systems that I liked about that was the companion system, which is now partially emulated by the garrison system
right.
with your followers. So...
Oh man, I could talk about the Old Republic, and I
like the Old Republic a lot.
I feel like it should have been just an online multiplayer, not an MMO. I think that it would have been more accessible. But this isn't BioWare, Bowie.
We should do an episode on BioWare games.
BioWare.
Anyway, so, and you know, it's worth mentioning there are tons of World of Warcraft books. Comic books, manga, there's a movie coming up.
Finally, after years of development now.
It's so funny because, you know, this episode, in a lot of ways, as you probably heard by our opening song, is dedicated to our fellow podcast Hunty Bunch sisters over at Horde House. You know, they've been kind of like, we'll see if this movie happens. And it's, I get it, but ever since they signed Duncan Jones on, Duncan Jones, of course, made Moon, he made Source Code.
David
He's
Bowie
the son
made him.
Of David Bowie. No, it was very clear this movie was really gonna get made. And so I'm no longer shocked, you know, and a lot of people are like freaking out, like, oh wow, the movie actually looks good. There is a super exclusive trailer shown at Comic-Con and then another one shown at BlizzCon. And
people are like, oh my god.
And people are like, oh my god. And I'm like, that's not a surprise. Have you seen Moon? That's one of the best movies I've ever seen. As soon as they brought him on board, I was sure that this was not only going to happen, but be great.
Yeah, so that's exciting.
Plus, Rob Kaczynski, who is super, super, super hot and in such films as Pacific Rim, is going to be in the Warcraft movie. And he's a hardcore, like, longtime player himself.
That's awesome. And, like, talking about kind of the legacy, so many famous people out there, like, have openly acknowledged playing the game. You know,
Let's wrap this multimedia part up. I want to ask you, Slaggy, do you have a favorite WoW book?
Favorite WoW book? I haven't really read too many of them.
I'm going to loan you my copy of Arthas, Rise of the Lich King. It is super good.
Yeah, I know that Christy Golden is really well thought of in the Warcraft book.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess she does other fantasy stuff as well, huh? But
and what about comics / manga? Do you have a favorite of there?
I haven't really read any
of them. I am going to loan you my copy of the World of Warcraft Death Knight manga.
Ooh, yeah.
It is just about the backstory of Thassarion and his, like, bromo-erotic.
Oh, his gay blood elf lover.
Yeah, it's super bromo-erotic. I ship it. Okay, well, and for those of you interested in the lore of Warcraft,
there are like
I would recommend
over 20
looking
books,
at some of this stuff. Yeah, there are so many books.
And I mean, they work
the Christy Golden ones are typically worth reading. The Richard Knack ones are typically worth reading. And a lot of the Warcraft manga is pretty good, although unfortunately the long-running DC comic series I did not find to be nearly as compelling.
Oh, that's a bummer.
There are also some spin-offs to talk about, but the only one I'm really going to discuss here, and only very briefly, because it's time to finish this episode. I just want to mention, you know, Warcraft, Blizzard's other big hit of the last couple of years would be Hearthstone, the Heroes of Warcraft.
I see a lot of former guildies still log on to play that very frequently.
Yeah, you know, it's available now on Windows, OS X, iPad, Windows 8 Touch. It's coming to Android tablets next month, and in the first quarter of 2015, it'll be coming to iPhone and Android phones. Yep. It is free to play, and you can definitely win without spending any money on cards. It's a very straightforward card game. I think it's a lot of fun, and I wholeheartedly recommend you check it out. You know, I'm sort of focusing this episode on people who maybe haven't played a lot of Warcraft, and even if this episode doesn't switch you onto wanting to play it, hopefully now you'll understand a little better why we love it so much.
I might like to recommend, if you're interested more in the kind of the history and the appeal, check out on YouTube or Hulu, Looking for Group. It's the documentary about the history of the World of Warcraft.
And if you are looking to get into Warcraft, a good stepping stone might be just checking out Hearthstone or just downloading the
Starter Edition.
The Starter Edition of
free,
World of Warcraft.
Free forever up to level 20.
It's free to play up to level 20.
Not a timed demo.
And, you know, the core game now is what, like a $20 purchase, including everything up to Mists of Pandaria?
Yep. There is the subscription fee, but, you know, worth it for me.
To me, it's definitely worth it. So
if I figure that $15 a month, you know, that's like that's the cost of like four games for a current gen system each year. And like, you know, the amount of time I put into World of Warcraft is a lot more enjoyment that I would get out of like four rando games that, you know, were not high on my tier.
Well, I disagree with your math, but I appreciate your point. Do you have any closing thoughts on World of Warcraft?
I like it. No, I think it's just like it's a testament to the game that even, you know, with times where I played less and, you know, I'm subscribed for a little bit, that I've been playing now for 6 years. So, 6.5 years. So,
excellent.
I mean, I'm like a veteran at this point. So, I mean, I think it's just a testament to, you know, really what Blizzard does and, you know, the appeal, even with, you know, dropping numbers, that is still a world that appeals to a lot of people. It's a really fun time.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, with that, let's get a little redundant and talk a little bit about
I said, hey, what's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
Slaggy, have you been playing anything that isn't World of Warcraft?
No. I did just buy, some people on my personal Twitter might have noticed that I took advantage of Target's buy two get one free deal. So I bought a trio of 3DS games. Steely Rhythm Curtain Call, I got, Fantasy Life, and I got Smash Brothers for 3DS. So, you know, definitely that was very much a great deal. I felt very happy with my loot from that because, you know, I definitely had been needing to pick up those games, but, you know, money had been a little tight. So that deal really was perfectly timed.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, I have been playing a lot of Warlords of Draenor these last few days, but before that, since the last episode, I started, played, and finished Bayonetta 2, which was amazing in every possible way.
Yes.
If you had told me ahead of time that Bayonetta 2 was going to be superior to Bayonetta 1 in every possible way, I would have doubted you. Like, it seems unlikely to have happened, but it really is. Bayonetta 2 is completely amazing. I absolutely love it. I cannot believe it got made. And if you have a Wii U and you have not played Bayonetta 2 yet, you absolutely owe it to yourself to pick it up and play it. It's incredible. I also have been playing a lot of iOS gaming lately. Two games I want to talk about real quick. The first is Ninja Village by Kairosoft. You might be familiar with Kairosoft from such games as Game Dev Story.
Oh, yeah. Is this the one that I was talking
about? Monster Village.
That you had it on your phone and I was snooping on your phone like, oh, that looks cute.
Yes. Basically, it's like a resource management sim type game. Not entirely dissimilar to what Slaggy was describing in relation to the garrisons feature in World of Warcraft. But in this game, you are managing a village full of ninja and raising them up to, like, unite all ninja clans under one shogun.
Aww.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's super, super fun. And I've also been playing a lot of Monster Strike. Ninja Village is a paid game, no microtransactions. Monster Strike is a free-to-play game with microtransactions for stamina and all that BS that I'm normally super against. But the actual game conceit, which it's actually made by a bunch of former Capcom devs, is somewhat like almost like a battle pinball game with online functionality.
Oh, neat.
So it's real skill-based. It's super skill-based, which I like. And the stamina requirements are not so bad that it's crippling. Like, I haven't spent any money on it yet, and I'm definitely progressing through the game at a good clip. So I have not felt restrained by the stamina yet, so I think it's probably pretty well-designed. Both of these games are available on iOS. I'm not sure about Android, but most Kairosoft games are. So Ninja Village is definitely, I would definitely say, is probably on Android. And I think they're both worth your time if you're looking for a quick diversion while you're on the train or bus or something. So with that, Slaggy, let's start up the wrap-up.
All right. So we're going to be going into our social links now. Before I do that, I want to remind you that you're always welcome to tweet at us at any time at GameBuoy.org. That's DOTORG.
GameBuoy.org. That's DOTORG.
Whether that's with answers to older questions of the week, you can also go ahead and mail us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Or, you know, you could go and comment on the old Facebook post and such. I find that a lot of you like to tweet or mailbuoy us.
Tweet.
You know, typically that's where we get from. Our question of the week this week is, this week, the obligatory World of Warcraft episode. Share your thoughts and experiences on the 10-year anniversary of this 10-year MMO titan. I see what you did there. Facebook bonus question was, where would you like to see WoW go in the future? What lessons would you like to see other games, MMO or otherwise, learn from this long-in-the-tooth pioneer of the genre? We got a response from Daniel over on Facebook, saying, although I played World of Warcraft on and off since launch day, I've never been really completely crazy over it. It has always been a really nice palate cleanser between addictions to other games like Final Fantasy XI, Star Wars The Old Republic, and Final Fantasy XIV. Also, unlike those other games, it's never a game that I've made friends through, but the game I've shared most with my real-world friends. The thing that WoW does that keeps me coming back again and again is how it manages to radically reinvent itself without really losing the core of what makes it fun. Each time I come back, I know the game is going to have overhauled something, like the talent trees or the class skills. Also, the permanent changes to the world that have taken place over the past 10 years provide a great sense of progress and development for someone who has been part of the world for 10 years. As long as the game keeps making its own attempt at staying fresh, I'll keep coming back once or twice a year. Yay!
That is great feedback, and something that I really was thinking about a lot during this episode is just how much things have changed and how excited I am now to see each and every change.
Right. Also on Facebook, we had a response to episode 66 listenable podcast from Ian from the Koopa Club. He said, interesting questions posed. I've been wondering some of the same stuff now that I've endured and finished The Evil Within and has been compared to the golden era of survival horror in some write-ups I've read. I didn't get that feeling at all. I'm not saying that this was a bad thing. Although not quite, Silent Hill was supposed to be the game to revive to revive survival horror. But I still think PT takes the crown. They put the SH in survival horror. Get it? SH, Silent Hill. LOL, okay, not too clever, but cannot wait to listen to
this. I thought
it
was clever.
Yeah. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Ian.
Over on Twitter, we had some more discussion about... So over on Twitter, we had a couple of tweets. Your Enzyme said, found myself singing along to Rumor Has It segment intro. Thank God I was alone in my car. Aww. And Miru69 said, in regards to our LP, awesome episode. While I haven't played all Silent Hill titles, I still remember playing the first one and getting scared. Yeah, super spoopy. And then, that retro code over on Twitter replied to Emiru69, said, I remember getting to the high school and getting stuck on the piano puzzle. It made no sense and I gave up. And then Emiru69 said, yeah, I remember that one. It was a tough one. Then that retro code said, it clues made no sense on that chalkboard. And, continues, I got it on my PS3. I just need to finish it and not commit seppuku with the camera and control. Yeah.
Or lack thereof.
In response to Podcast Cross Zone 2, video was up thanks to the folks over at GX. ActDef said, yes, with ease, not yes. So yes, with a happy face. So go check that out. And with that, I think it's time to thank you for your continued feedback. We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews.
We like them.
Your Facebook likes.
Like them.
We effing love tweeting on Twitter.
We effing love Twitter.
You can tumble with us on Tumblr, plus one us on Google+. Email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And of course, our home base is gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
Captain Spike, how about the shoutouts?
As ever and always, I'd like to start my shoutouts with a mention of Koopa Club. That's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist.
What awards did they win?
I believe it was from their mothers.
Aww.
We've also got VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, and The Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. Plus, the Nintendo Fun Club, platformers, positivity, and pop punk.
I like those names.
Me too. In non-gaming news, of course, I've got to point you in the direction of reading as fundamental. Slaggy's currently off-season show about RuPaul's Drag Race with guests me, Rob Roberts, and Delvin from VG Realness.
Get your tucks and weaves ready, hunty.
I also got to point you in the direction of the Starboard Power Coupling podcast. The Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. I also need to point you to X Nation over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. And last but not least, the wrestling podcast, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, do you want to take us to a game bar?
As ever and always, I want to shout out to my homegirls over at Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They are part of the Hunty Bunch and basically the gay video game Prairie Home Companion, Lindsay Lohan version. Speaking of Lindsay Lohan and her wildness, there's also wildness over at the Nerdgasm Network, who's maybe a little bit more like a band of Bynes, because they're the wildest shock jock video game radio show that you'll ever come across. They're a bag of hot dicks. Their words, not mine, but I agree. Speaking of WoW, I cannot recommend a better WoW show than Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO. If there's one thing I could change about the game, it would be that we could log in and play with Syl and her friends over in Europe. And also, starting its life as a World of Warcraft show, but growing into all things online gaming, but never too seriously, is Horde House between Rob Roberts, Extifer, and Grandpa. And that's over on the Voice of Keats Network, along with Girls Gone WoW, VogNetwork.com. And last, but certainly not least, is La Palanca Podcast, the podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. As ever and always, our wonderful theme music was done by the late, great Zelda Reorchestrated, which was the project that aimed to rearrange Zelda music in beautiful symphonic sound. We will forever be pouring out a 40 into the Great Fairy Fountain. That fear's getting a little drunk.
With all that having been said, Slaggy, thank you so much for being here recording with me today. I know it's been a long episode. Furthermore, to all of our dear listeners, whom we adore, thank you for spending this lovely Sunday afternoon / evening with us. We really appreciate you spending your time listening to us. I know you have a lot of options. We have some exciting stuff coming up for you in the coming weeks. But until then, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And
time to check our garrisons. Seriously, I need to check my garrison.
Garrison break.
These Japanese DLC, all 8 of the next wave of amiibos will be coming out on January 22nd.
The plural of amiibo is still amiibo.
Oh, sorry.
The game is finally going from alpha into beta starting in January.
What game is that?
I'm just gonna fucking restart that. StarCraft II Legacy of the Void is currently...